Is that your...
$375
You know, I hope it was worth it. It doesn't even tell you what order to do on that.
Is that what we are? Okay. Well, good morning, everyone. Good morning. We have Agency 48 before us this morning. Department of Health, Mr. Tom Forslund, new director of the agency, and Mr. Bob Peck. And just a couple of housekeeping things.
Housekeeping?
All right. Well, the way we're going to run the meeting today is I would like to take a break about every hour and a half for about 10 minutes. We will take a lunch hour, and I'd like us to be punctual. This is a big budget, but I do believe that we do need to stretch. So if we could stick to that, that would be great. So thank you, Mr. Forslund. Welcome.
Madam Chairman.
Okay. Excuse me, Tom, before you start. Sure, we can go ahead with Mr. Mai from the LSO office to discuss the Life Resource Center issue, and then we'll go from there. Sorry about that, Tom. Go ahead, Bill.
Mr. Chairman, I guess just to kind of get this thing out in the open so that the committee's aware of it, everybody who's looked at LSO's 113 profile is aware of it. There's an issue in this budget that comes up. I think it's in the... mid 200s, somewhere in there. It's Wyoming Life Resource Center. And they're changing the way that I think they've, and the department can get into the details of it, but I think it's an agreement with CMS and the way Medicaid works and all. They have to change the way they pay for that Life Resource Center. In the past, there's been this time there's budgeted to be a little over $21 million of what used to be called, and may still be called for all I know, ICFMR monies from the federal government that we would deposit into the general fund. It's counted as a general fund revenue, and then it gets doled out along with the general fund match to the WLRC. And the department, because of this agreement with CMS, I believe, has to change the way they put that money forward. Well, when it was carried forward in the budget, I think the budget document is accurate. It looks right to me and all. But the problem is it never came off of the profile. And so those governor's profiles and all that you saw in the governor's documents were overstating revenues available. In other words, they didn't take that 21 and change out of revenues. So the next profile you see from us is going to reflect that $21 million as not being available revenue. We'll show a separate line in the general fund, you know, taking that out as a governor's rec. And the bottom line is you'll be close to $48 million underwater on the gov's rec side of things.
Go ahead, Mr.
And then there's the issue with respect to the CIO. We might as well get that out on the table, too.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, there are some issues right now that we're trying to sort out with CIO and how they want to go about billing for their services. The way it currently stands, if we go with the current plan from the CIO, and I think A&I and CIO want to come back on a call back on Monday, if possible, if there's, you know, time permitting. But the way it currently stands is I think you guys are going to see another hit of about $4 million to that general fund again. You're actually going to probably be underwater about $51 million to start out as a gov's rec. And the whole thing ties back to – the way that revenues are billed, the way that expenses for services are billed back to the federal government. And the way they want to do this with giving up the internal services funding model that currently exists in A&I with ITD and CIO, you know, that's billed back to the agents. The agencies pay their services through internal service funds. So in other words, you appropriate general fund monies to those agencies, and they use that general fund to leverage the federal fund matching that, you know, in the case, or other funds matching that they're eligible for. And then they pay back that lump in the form of internal service transfers to those two divisions. And what's been proposed in this 306 budget that you have is getting away from that. And the bottom line, as near as we can tell, and again, this may change a little bit, but as near as we can tell, we met about it again last night to make sure we were all kind of on the same page about this. And near as we can tell is you're going to do it that way, you essentially have to give up 13, 14 federal funds. You're not going to have the ability to leverage those federal funds because you're not going to, under that scenario, you're not going to appropriate the general fund monies to those agencies. They therefore aren't going to leverage them against, you know, to gain the federal funds, pay back through internal services. So their hope is that via cost allocation, that by 15-16, they essentially get back to square one. But the bottom line is 13-14 results in a biennium of lost federal revenues under that scenario.
And that you essentially defer the dollars till 15 and 16, or you just lose it and never get it back?
Mr. Chairman, the way, you know, we kind of all tried to put our heads together last night about this thing, and I think we all came to the conclusion it's basically a cost. And I think it's a cost that isn't fully reflected. Again, it's not fully reflected on this profile. We're trying to get some information, some summaries together that will make sense to everybody, because again, if it doesn't make sense to us, it ain't going to make sense to you guys, and worse yet, it's not going to make sense to anybody out on the floor. So we're trying to get it nailed down to the point where it does, and right now that's our best guess, is about, it may be just a shade shy of $4 million. Anyway, all that said, If we profile it that way, if we profile the Gov's rec that way, he'd be about $52 million underwater instead of the 26.6.
So right now on the goldenrod, we're showing about $26 million underwater. We're closer to $52 underwater.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Director Forslund's got that in his budget.
Hence the timing.
I was thinking, Mr. Co-Chairman, that maybe we ought to start over and come back tomorrow with that news. Anyway, any other questions, Mr. Co-Chairman, before we start? Okay, thank you, Mr. Mai, for the update. All right, again, Mr. Forslund, we'll start with your budget.
Madam Chairman, Mr. Nye, thank you very much for the positive warm-up for the audience. With me today is a number of my senior staff that I would like to introduce. As first of all, as Representative Berger said, my name is Tom Forslund. I'm the new director of the Department of Health. To my right is Bob Peck, who is the chief financial officer for the department. Sitting behind me, Dr. Wendy Braun. She is the senior administrator for public health division, as well as the state health officer. Next is Chris Newman, who's the senior administrator in charge of behavioral health. Next one is Terry Green, senior administrator for healthcare financing or Medicaid. Next is April Getchess, as the senior administrator for aging. And lastly, Meredith Acey is the administrator in the director's unit for policy research and evaluation. So that's the staff who's accompanying me today for the budget review. First off, I would need to apologize to you all. I have a department. We've been sharing a bug, and a number of us have been ill. And today my ears are stopped up and my voice is quite weak, and I'm not hoping it will last all day. So in order to help, I planned on making the total presentation today of the budget, but I'm afraid that I'm going to have to ask Bob Peck to assist me as we go through this today. And then I will provide some of the explanation of the items as we go forward. Again, I'm sorry, but I really can't help it. To get started, I would ask for your indulgence to allow me to give you a brief overview of some of the changes that are taking place within the agency as well as a few of our initiatives. I feel they are pertinent to the budget discussions that we're going to have throughout the day. And I've included some of the information to you in your in the handout number 144, and I will reference some of those items as we go through that right now.
Everyone has a copy.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to cover five areas. First of all, the reorganization of the department. Secondly, a review of the new divisions and a little bit of a history of the budget growth that has occurred within the department and within the different initiatives or the different divisions. Thirdly, the performance management initiative that we have going throughout the department. Fourth, the update on the current 11-12 budget. And finally, an overview of the 13-14 budget. So, again, the first item I will talk about is the reorganization of the department. A directive that was given to me when I first was employed by the governor was to look at the operations of the department and make changes where necessary. The governor had asked me to do the evaluation. Additionally, the legislature this last session had appropriated funding for a reorganization study. After I started and after did the review, I felt restructuring was needed for a variety of reasons. I decided to proceed with the changes. If you'll take a look at page number one and number two of the handout, page number two was the organizational chart as the department existed when I started. And page one is as it exists today. As I was going through the review of the department, the philosophy I wanted to or that I followed for making the structural changes was, first of all, I wanted to flatten the organizational structure as much as possible to improve the divisional administrator's access to the director. Secondly, align like functions, basically reduce the number of divisions and offices. Three, break down the silos that are within the department. I think the silos have been created for a couple of reasons. One is the organizational structure, but two has been federal grants, a number of federal grants that the department has received over the years. And finally, we need to break down the silos to address some of the complex issues that cut across divisional lines. Examples are aging issues, Title 25, chronic disease. Those are some of the things. We put the new organizational structure into place this past summer and fall. Currently we have, as you see, is the director's office and four operating divisions. Those are public health, behavioral health, healthcare financing, and aging. What I will do next is go through a quick overview of the new organizational structure. If you could turn to page number three there. And this is the overall department. And I kind of describe this outlay or this layout of the form. What it shows is, first of all, the first block just is a quick description of the division. Now, this first page is the whole department, but as I go through each of these pages, it'll be on a division. The second block gives some basic statistics for the department or the division. So, as an example, in this case, It shows that 54% of this department is federally funded, 45% generally funded, and we have 1,526 authorized positions, et cetera. The middle block there then shows our budget, total budget on top, and it shows four bienniums, three, 07, 08, 09, 10, 11, 12, and then this is the proposed 13, 14. And that shows in the total growth. If you see that that shaded area on the top right there at $521,600,000, that would show the growth from starting at 07, 08 up to 13, 14. Then underneath it just shows how much of that's federal, how much of it's state, how much of it's other. The third block there, or fourth block, I should say, is the authorized positions and how much growth there has been in the agency and in the respective division over that time period. And the last one shows where the growth has occurred. Now, this is at a very high level, kind of a 30,000 feet look at it. But if you take a look at it as an example, director's office, 12 million, healthcare financing, et cetera, it all runs down to a total of 521.6. And see, and that ties back to that middle chart at 521.6. And so this essentially is the format that I did. And I asked for this to be done because I kind of wanted to have a high-level view to see where's the department been, where it is now, where's the growth, how much growth, and where's it's occurred. So I won't go over every item there, but move on to the next page, which is the director's office. That's page number 4. Again, if you see here, the total budget growth was $12 million. 11.7 of that is general fund within this respective division. There's been a growth of 18 people within this division, but all that occurred in 11-12 because of consolidation of IT throughout the division within before IT positions were located throughout the whole department. And now they were all pulled into one budget group back in 11-12 time period. So then you go down to where is the budget growth, this $12 million come from. 7.4 of it has come from the tax refund funding program through House Bill 238. So over half the growth here was there. The consolidation of IT, 3.6.
What's the director on the House Bill 238, would you remind us what that is?
Go ahead. Madam Chair and Mr. Co-Chair, back I think it was probably 4 years ago now, they raised the income limits and the refund limit for the tax refund. It was Representative Childers proposed a bill that increased the income level by almost 50%, I believe. I think it went from like 18 to 27 for a single person. And then the maximum refund was increased from 800 to 900 for married. I think it was 500 to 600 for single. Madam Chair and Mr. Chairman, yes, it's actually a refund of property taxes, utility taxes, and sales taxes is the way the statute reads.
And then the last increase is the salary and benefits over that time period. So that's the $12 million, yeah, again, at a high level. Moving on to the next. Excuse me, before I move on, a few things I'd like to point out in the director's office. This operation uh, We have fiscal services located within the director's office now. Previously, fiscal services were located throughout the agency. They have now been consolidated for the first time. Also, director's office, we have the new Office of Health Policy and Valuations. And as I mentioned, we have three legislative studies that are pending dealing with within the department that the legislature has directed us to do. First one is the cost study, which we're estimating the cost of the new Medicaid participants as a result of the ACA. The second one is option study, coming up with ways to improve Medicaid and contain costs. The third study that has been authorized by the legislature was a reorganization study, and that bill said that we should look at ways to reorganize the Wyoming Department of Health. As I already mentioned, that we have done that ourselves, and it has been completed. As a result, the $100,000 that was appropriated was not needed, and we have not spent any of it. We have offered that up to the Labor, Health, and Social Services Committee for the option study, because the option study only had $100,000 appropriated, and there's potentially not going to be enough money to do everything the legislature wants to do with that. And so when we met with them earlier this fall, we mentioned that we'd like to have more time to do that study, and if they want us to do all the things that are in there, it's going to take more money. But we did offer up the $100,000, so you might be seeing that. Okay, now moving on to page number five. This is health care financing. Functions within this costs are this division includes Medicaid, Medicaid waivers, and Kid Care CHIP. Terry Green is the senior administrator, and she oversees this. Roxanne Homer, who I inadvertently forgot to introduce earlier, is the deputy director of healthcare financing. She is with us today also. Medicaid overall is a large program for the state. I know people are quite frustrated with the cost of
Excuse me, Mr. Director. Senator Von Platern.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Forslin, I'm just a little confused. I want to make sure I understand your charts. So on the director's office, and even on the healthcare finance, the way you don't add across to get total growth in that middle box, total growth is $12 million in that director's office. But what are each year add? Do you add them together, or what does that mean?
It's
go ahead,
Madam Chairman, Senator Flattering. That is the what you start at 9.8, and it's at 21.8 currently. So you see, there's a $12 million growth over from the base of 2007-08 to the proposed 2013-14.
Other questions, committee? Continue, Tom.
Okay, going back to Medicaid, as I mentioned, it's a large program. I know people are frustrated with costs. I've heard it consistently since when I was first announced as the potential director of the department. People have talked to me about the high cost of Medicaid, and can anything be done with it? And so certainly one of the things that we are looking at within the department is what we can do with Medicaid and Medicaid costs. One of the things that I've discovered very quickly is that we really have to better define what the problems are, and we need to better understand our issues. I think people are too quick to present solutions without better understanding the issues. As an example, we need to better understand our cost drivers, and this is something that we're spending time doing now. We're trying to work at better understanding where the costs are coming from and what we need to do to try to better control them. As a result, one of the things we've done is started to do some data mining. And I'll give you an example on page number 6. And I think this is a report that we got earlier this fall. And I just wanted to give you a brief overview of part of the problem that that we have. And what you see on page number 6 is a 95-5 recipient analysis. What that means is if you go to the first line, which says adults, it says that we have 20,577 adults, and they're costing us $2,421 a person per year. So essentially, if you multiply that times the 20,000 plus, you end up with about approximately $50 million in costs for those roughly 21,000 people. That's the bottom 95% of that adult group. If you move over to the top 5%, you've got 1,082 people, and they're on average costing us $29,615 a person, or $32 million for the group. And you go on down, you take a look at some of our most expensive people on the program are the disabled group. And you take a look at the bottom 95%, they're costing us nearly $15,000 a person per year. And at the top 5%, they're costing us about $129,000 a person. So essentially, 500 people are costing $64 million a year in this grouping. So this is just an example of what we're saying is that for us to take a look at trying to control costs, as an example, that the children's side, we could spend a lot of time and effort trying to control the children in this program, but ultimately at $1,209 a person per year, it's not going to have a significant impact on the program versus at the lower 95% compared to some of the higher-end clients. Now, the question is, can you do anything about the cost of those top 5%? And if, you know, in some cases, maybe, in a lot of cases, no. But the question is, can you have, this is the top quintile, can you have the quintile just below that being able to do something to stem their drive towards or movement towards the top, you know? And so we are exploring, trying to figure out where our opportunities are, where our costs are, and where our opportunities are. So that's just an example.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bonslater.
Just a quick question, Director. Is this just state money or is this the combined?
This is total Medicaid cost, which is 50-50 combination.
Thank you for this analysis.
Okay, moving on to next.
Senator Meyer.
Tom, I noticed on page 5, though, your enrollment growth was almost half of the anticipated future costs. So could you tell us a little bit about that?
Mr. Forslund?
Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, in terms of you see there that there has been a large increase in the number of people have come on the program in recent years. And that has driven certainly the cost of the Medicaid program. But again, when you take a look at that, is that if you take a look at the numbers who are coming on But then you have to take a look at how high costs they are. A lot of times when they first come on, they have pent-up demand. Their costs will go up. They'll spike for a period of time. Then they'll start to level off. Secondly, though, is if some of the people who come on are in that top 5%, they will spike it, and it certainly will keep it up there and just get even higher. But again, there is a direct correlation between the unemployment rate of the state and the enrollment in on Medicaid. That was one of the things that I asked early on, and we did some data mining, and there is a direct correlation in Wyoming, and so I got that confirmed. The problem is when the unemployment rate drops, we're not seeing necessarily the drop in people off the Medicaid rolls necessarily. And might be a variety of reasons for that, but at this point in time, I cannot give you an adequate explanation for sure on that.
Okay. Follow-up, Senator Meyer, and then Senator Hatton.
Yeah. Senator Chairman, Tom, I can give you one reason. It's something we've been trying to work on, and it's the relationship between DFS and your department and eligibility standards and requirements. Right now, it's a year. DFS doesn't look at determining eligibility except on an annual basis. And we had hoped we could get that down to 6 months, but I thought we had an understanding. But between the musical chairs of the directors of both agencies, we lost that communication. And I hope we can reestablish that and maybe get that eligibility criteria protocol down to 6 months rather than a year. Then maybe when somebody gets a job, they might actually be, checked out to see whether or not they're still eligible. So I think that's one of the reasons why they don't fall off. You don't check them for a year. And it's not you. It's DFS.
Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, I understand your frustration. The problem is that currently, federal law will not permit us to drop it to less than a year at this point in time because we cannot make it more restrictive, eligibility any more restrictive for a period of years as a result of federal regulations. We can't do it. As much as we'd like to, I'd have no objection to doing it. It's called maintenance of effort, and we cannot make that change in the next few years.
Further questions, Senator Meyer? Okay, thank you. Senator Hastert?
Hi. Yeah, thank you. Director Forslund, on the other medicated services is $43 million. Could you give me an example of what just a few examples of what others are?
Madam Chairman, Senator Hastert, there's probably 40 items in there. As an example, pharmaceuticals would be one. I'm thinking of mental health services. Hospitals.
Representative Wallace, you're done? Okay. Representative Edmund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to refresh my memory and to go back to Senator Meyer's question about enrollment, that I remember our discussion, that has to do with the fact that we took our monies. Am I right on that? I remember that discussion a year ago that the enrollment, we were locked down in our enrollment because we took our funds, and now it's out, and I don't remember the date that we said. I think it had something to do with the new health care law as well.
Mr. Forslund?
Madam Chairman, Representative, yes, that is the case, that as when the state agreed to take ERA funding, this was one of the stipulations that was put into place, and it is into 2019. For children, 2016 for adults.
Representative Walsh.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm just wondering, What would be the consequences if the state of Wyoming established a different maintenance of effort? What would be the response from the federal government if we said, in order to maintain our budget, it's necessary for us to make sure that the people who are receiving these benefits are eligible for them, and just do it.
Mr. Forslund?
Madam Chairman, Representative Wallace, I'm probably every state in the country has that issue currently, is that they can't make adjustments. Most of the states are in worse financial condition than the state of Wyoming at the current time, and I'm not aware of any state that has, at this point in time, taken that risk to say, we don't care what you say, we have to make this change. Whether the federal government would turn around and reduce and or eliminate Medicaid match, I don't know. But you're putting $500 million, certainly, with federal funding at risk, potentially.
You have follow-up? Senator Nicholas?
You know, this phenomena of the numbers going up during high unemployment or increasing unemployment, and we're not seeing the drop-offs, and wondering whether or not an eligibility testing at 6 months interval will make a significant impact of these dollars. I don't know. I guess that's a proposition or a thesis you'd have to test to see whether or not that in fact happens. But what I'm wondering is when we look at the job market numbers and we see people essentially leaving the job, going on to these services, and then the unemployment declines, but we're not seeing people coming off the rolls. Are these people essentially opting out to go into educational opportunities that we're providing, and they continue to take services? Do we know what's happening here? Because my sense is that 6 months isn't going to make a huge difference in the numbers that we're talking about. There's some other phenomena happening. People are going on Medicaid, and they're just never coming off.
Mr. Forslund?
Madam Chair, Senator Nicholas, that is a question I cannot answer at this point in time. I scratch my head at it, too, and I wish I knew a lot more about some of the human dynamics of this, you know, that impact this program, and I just can't answer that at this point in time. And like, I totally agree with you, in order to test that, you know, you would have to implement some of the different initiatives that currently we cannot do, other than then to do some random sampling and talk to people.
I mean, I hear what you're saying, but if you have folks losing jobs that have health care benefits and new jobs are becoming available that have no health care benefits and they're still means tested in, they could still have jobs and still be eligible. They could go to the university, the community college. We have wonderful recruitment programs to get folks there. They could continue eligibility there. They come off the rolls as unemployed because they're now students. I mean, there's a whole variety of explanations. It seems to me that that data ought to be available through ANI or something. But let's stop there. What does it take to go out and learn more about what's actually going on? Is your data so private and sensitive that we can't find out, or is it you can't marry it up with the ANI labor statistics?
Madam Chairman, Senator Nicholas, the state does not have a tremendous amount of ability to do data mining at this point in time. We have a very antiquated MMIS system, and that's has been one challenge. You know, I have a lot more questions than I'm able to get answer for. I frustrate a lot of my people within the department because I keep asking questions, and it's very hard to get answers for. And I get a lot of anecdotal responses, but I don't have the hardcore data to be able to answer questions like you're asking here. Now, what's it going to take? We're going to have to beef up our not only our technological capability, but also the internal expertise within the department to be able to do data analysis and to, again, do a better job at trying to understand our information and extract it and use it in a meaningful way.
Mm-hmm. I guess, Director, I understand your frustration, and I'm sharing it with you right now. I mean, at a billion-dollar budget, we have cost increases that we can't control. We ask questions that we've been asking, frankly, for every year for 10 years that I've been on this committee, and we're either provided answers that are unsatisfactory or we're told that that data is not available. So I sort of throw it back to you to say, look, what's the plan then to change it? I mean, if it takes two more employees and $5 million, given the risk and the dollars, that's peanuts. So I'll accept your frustration, but if you don't give us a proposal to how to help you, then it's all yours. If you want us to help us, give us a budget and a plan to change that, and then we'll share it with you. But until you give us a plan to say, look, I need three employees and $5 million in the OCIO effort, until you ask for that, it's still shouldered on you. We can help you, but you've got to tell us exactly what it's going to cost you, us, to help you get that information so that a year from now you can give us all those answers.
Mr. Porcelain.
Madam Chairman. Senator Nicholas, there's I'll take that as an invitation to provide some recommendations to you. However, regardless of being able to present a plan to you to have it implemented and presenting and getting results within 12 months, I think is a bit optimistic, but that beside the point, there will be some things in this budget, recommendations to you that will begin to address some of these issues.
And Mr. Porcelain, are we able to do sampling without going against the federal mandates in order to just get better understanding of where the areas of difficulty are in addressing the funding issue?
Madam Chairman, yes, we can do sampling. We can gather information. We cannot tighten the eligibility requirements.
Okay, good. Thank you. Other questions, Mr. Borsman? Go ahead.
Madam Chairman, but also there's one other thing that I would like to point out, and that is in response to Senator Nicholas about uncontrolled costs. If you take a look at under budget growth, the second largest item on that list is optional services or optional waivers, and those are totally controllable by the legislature. Those are not mandated services. Those are optional services that the legislature has elected to add to the program.
And Mr. Porcelain, on optional waivers, we did discuss this last year, went through that, and I'm assuming we'll spend some time on that today. But no one was willing to cut any of those services once you get to it. So,
yes,
correct.
What I have, in fact, been told by legislators is no way are they not interested in cutting. They're much more interested in adding to the list.
Thank you. All right.
Okay.
Continue. Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Back to my other question. Let me turn that around. Well, let me start this from a different place. 30 years ago, I was a single mom with three kids, and I needed the help of the state for a short period of time while I was going to school. At that time, if my circumstances changed at any point, I got a new job, something, you know, I finished my schooling, whatever that was, I was required to report that immediately. Is that no longer the case? So now, 30 years later, we have a situation where if your circumstances change as a recipient of these benefits and you now have a job where you have insurance available, that you're not required to report that and you remain eligible for a year regardless?
Madam Chairman, Representative Wallace, no, it is the same.
In that case, why can't we look at, take a good hard look at those changing circumstances at a more quicker than a year?
Madam Chairman, Representative Wallace, by moving it from a review of every 12 months to every 6 months is a change in a tightening of the restrictions, or not restrictions, but of the eligibility determination, and essentially the federal government says you cannot make any changes during this time period.
I think what Representative Wallace is saying is, look, if we have an investigation unit, they go out, and if they see people that have had changes of circumstances, that constitutes a theft of services at that point, if they're not reporting. And I think our assumption is if you begin to enforce that, people will respond as she did, and that is, I got a job, and you don't come down any, you report it.
Representative, or Chairman Berger, Senator Nicholas, you're absolutely right. I mean, if somebody reports, in other words, their next-door neighbor is on a Medicaid and they got a job and they're working and they have benefits, that's called in. It will be investigated. I mean, that's a violation. And there's in other words, they don't get a get out of jail card free as a result of that. I mean, they are in violation, and so an investigation will take place.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Edmonds.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So how vigorously do we publicize fraud investigation? Do we spend any advertising? I mean, I've seen lots of advertising from the Department of Health. Do we advertise so that the neighbor knows? And what kind of vigorous fraud investigations do we do internally? Is it simply someone has to call the department, or is that it? I mean, does somebody just have to call the department before we investigate?
If, Madam Chairman, in terms of the investigations, or in terms of the prosecution, the Attorney General's office handles that. There was just a case recently that got quite a bit of publicity, so those cases do generate publicity. However, generally, though, it's on the provider side that seems to have the most interest. In terms of the individual, it won't get the publicity that that a pharmacist or a physician who's defrauded the agency just won't get the same type of interest from the media. And so, no, you don't see that type of information that's stories out there like you will for on the provider side. In terms of how the investigations work, if you want, I could ask Terry Green to go into more detail at this point if you want. Terry?
Carolyn, do you have the mic? Thanks. And Terry, if you would come over here to between the two desks, like at the center of the door. We've got a feedback thing with our speakers.
Madam Chair, Terry Green, State Medicaid Agent and Senior Administrator for the Division of Healthcare Financing. Currently, our eligibility enrollment is done in the Department of Family Services. The Department of Health sets policy and does training for the Department of Family Services, and they historically have done their own monitoring of determinations. That process is called Medicaid Eligibility Quality Control. It's required by the federal government. Random samples are conducted throughout the year. Every year, different groups are looked at. We have not been satisfied, if you will, with the results of those reviews and outcomes. So in the last year since Director Forsland has come on board, we have worked to take that process over, and now we'll be providing the quality control for eligibility determinations. In the process of a client applying for eligibility, they do currently get 12 months of continuous enrollment. That does not mean that if they get income, they don't have to report it. They certainly do. We also do a look at wage and income information from other departments in the state. If, in fact, we have a cross-match with another department, whether it's for income or for other resources through human service programs, we follow up on that and have a look at income. Those clients can be immediately referred for investigation. In regard to the maintenance of effort, that does come from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. It states in there that our enhanced match that we received for several years would be at stake if, in fact, we violated the maintenance of effort guidance, which says you cannot make applying for Medicaid any more restrictive than it was at the time the ARRA was implemented. Does not mean you can't review clients, and it doesn't mean we don't review clients. We certainly do.
And Ms. Green, that enhanced match was from 50 to 59% when we negotiated?
It actually was up to 62%, 61-59 at one point.
A change every quarter.
Representative Edmonds.
So can you give me the total of the match, the federal total of what we got?
Mr. Peck?
I believe it. What was our total ARRA funding?
Approximately $125 million.
Okay. Would you repeat that, please, Terry?
Approximately $125 million.
You have further questions? Okay, Representative Esquivel and then Patterson.
Okay, Madam Chairman, Ms. Green, a couple questions. When you look at income, do you look at all types of income or just their job? Do you look at child support, alimony, rental?
Madam Chair, Representative Esquivel, all income is evaluated.
And Madam Chairman, I don't see why we don't have employers reporting Social Security numbers to the Department of Employment and that they're not able to cross-reference when someone is employed. I'm assuming that those Social Security numbers are on the Medicaid forms that they fill out in order to qualify. And maybe that is the system that Director Forsen was talking about that was antiquated, that we're not able to do that at this point. But
Madam Chair, Representative Esquivel, we do a cross-match with the Department of Workforce Services on income information.
Representative Pedersen.
Just to refresh my memory, a lot of times when we get expanding match or other possibilities of growing our Medicaid numbers, oftentimes it expands our eligibility, and then in order to receive the more dollars, and then if we then when the dollars stop, we still have that expanded eligibility. And if I remember, that was not the case with ARRA funds that you just referenced. Is that true?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not sure I get the question.
So last year we had, Madam Chair, last year we had a couple of things, and we brought it up earlier in the committee, where we could have received more Medicaid dollars, but we would have expanded, and there was a few different categories of places that we do not currently have within the client base of eligibility. And then when those federal dollars go away, when the excess federal dollars go away for the one-time boost, then we still have to cover as a state, which was the floor argument as to why not to accept the dollars last year. That was not the case with the R funds, if I remember correctly, and I'm trying to go back through that. Do I have that right?
So the only opportunity I know of for expanding a group with additional funding at this point is through the Affordable Care Act. And in that, states had an opportunity to immediately cover a group that's that wasn't previously eligible for Medicaid. Under ARRA, there was not any expanded groups. Under basic Medicaid, every state has an opportunity of what groups to cover outside of the mandatory groups. And we have very, very, very small numbers of programs that are expanded.
Senator Nicholas.
Madam Chairman, I'm listening to this conversation, and I know the frustration, because I remember when the ARRA funds were proposed, we put in a budgetary language that said that no ARRA dollars could be drawn down without the governor's signature. And I don't remember anybody coming in and saying, by the way, if we draw down these additional ARRA dollars, that our maintenance effort will be reexamined in light of these dollars, so that we can't change things like the 6 months eligibility. Having said that, my bias remains that people kind of know what the requirements are, and while there will be some folks that will not report when they get jobs, that's going to be infrequent, I really think, and that's it's a crime. You're going to get charged with it. And when I look at and watch these number enrollments go, I mean, the list of things that I've got here that are really causing us to let this budget skyrocket out are some things that we know about. Every time we put on the optional programs, not only do we increase our own dollars, but that recruits people onto other parts of the program. When we put in S-CHIPs, we brought on more people. People that typically didn't go in said, they come in the office and said, oh, by the way, here's a host of other menued items that you're entitled to do. The argument being that if you're entitled to them, you receive them. With respect to jobs, I think we're seeing an evolution in Wyoming where we have more jobs without insurance. If you look at all the job growth that's been recorded and reported to us by the ANI, almost always the job growths were in the oil and gas industries. Those were the good jobs. Those jobs have dropped off. They're the higher paying jobs, and they went to the Bakken Shale. And we also learned a lot of those folks didn't relocate to their families. They stayed where they were, knowing that this gas boom was going to change, and now they're living in man camps in North Dakota instead of Wyoming. Jobs, and a real concern is that our unemployment rate is declining, partly because people are going off the rolls because they're going to educational opportunities, or they're getting jobs without serious income. And the other thing I'd throw in is that lifestyles have changed, where it used to be that if man and woman if the woman had children and she was living with somebody, they get married, they come off the rolls. Now, you don't get married. You could have an income in the household and not become ineligible because you don't look at the non-married partner. And we have a huge change in lifestyles and that. And all of these things are resulting in this escalation that we don't seem to be able to control. But and this year we're going to be looking at the question of do you reduce it. We have another number of optional things that we'll be viewing here, but we'll see whether if we want to cut back, there's mechanisms to cut back. I guess where I'm leading to this is, one is, how do we know if these things are making a difference? How do we evaluate them? If they are, they are. And then if at some point you say, okay, we can't afford it, let's start dropping off the optional programs. Can we drop off an optional program at any given time, or do we have any maintenance of effort prohibition to drop an optional program at this time?
Mr. Portland.
Madam Chairman, Senator Nicholas, we cannot drop a program just arbitrarily.
Yeah, right. Senator Meyer. Are you done? Okay, go ahead.
Dropping because you can no longer afford it, that's deemed arbitrary.
At this point in time, and we've got the maintenance of effort requirement that we're faced with. However,
Terry, we're talking about maintenance of effort and redoing the plan.
This gets a little more complicated, so I'm going to have to ask Ms. Green to talk about that in a little more detail.
Madam Chair, a couple of things. In the Medicaid program, in our agreement with the federal government, there are certain services that are required and certain services that are optional. So we have mandatory and optional services. There's optional medical services, and then in Wyoming, we have elected to create 6 waiver programs. Waivers are also optional. Those two pieces do not necessarily fall under maintenance of effort in the eligibility component, in that optional services could be reduced or eliminated if, in fact, we had a statutory change and then a change in our state plan. As far as waiver programs go, the optional waivers the state has determined to cover, I believe that those do fall under maintenance of effort. However, you can let a waiver expire, so you don't have to choose to renew it in your state at the period of time at which it's been approved by the federal government.
Go ahead.
Are there waiver programs that are set to expire?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman, Senator Nicholas. Every waiver has a end date to it, and approximately a year prior to that end date, a state would start a process with the federal government to renew that waiver.
Are there waivers set to expire during this biennium?
Ms. Newman? No. Maybe you could give us the dates if you know them.
Madam Chair, Senator Nicholas, for the 3 developmental disability waivers, the adult developmental disabilities waiver and the acquired brain injury waiver expire in 2014, and the children's developmental disabilities waiver expires in 2015.
I don't want to get into the adult and children programs, but the ABI program. I was here when we started it, and frankly, one of our colleagues, Dr. Miley over here, said, "You're going to regret the day that you started this," and he'd say that over and over, and many of you guys remember Dr. Miley. And so with the ABI program, we're now being called upon to increase the number of slots and decrease, but For a person that's going on the ABI program, are these people that are otherwise Medicaid eligible generally because they've spent down their assets, And then by getting on the ABI program, they get access to resources they wouldn't otherwise get.
Ms. Newman?
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, when a person is determined to be, they have to be determined to be financially eligible for the acquired brain injury waiver. So if, which often happens with acquired brain injury, unlike our developmental disabilities waiver, many of the people who do get on that waiver have worked in the past before their injury. So they, there are a number of people who do not qualify, and there are some who qualify who do need to spend down before they are deemed financially eligible. Then once they are deemed eligible financially and clinically for the waiver and are funded, then they are, as with all waivers, they also are eligible for the state plan Medicaid and receive those services.
So what are the services that the ABI program provides that just the state plan would not provide?
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair.
I know, it's erratic.
I'm trying not to move at all. As with all waivers, the waivers are allowed to fund services that are not covered under the state plan or that are limited under the state plan. Specific to the acquired brain injury waiver, it is covering day habilitation services, residential habilitation services, supported living services. So those are all services trying to help that person regain and then maintain some of the independent living skills that they had before their injury. There's also cognitive retraining. Again, same approach is to try to redevelop some of those skills and their ability to live as independently as possible. And then case management and those types of some therapies.
Just out of curiosity with the ABI program, do you know, for example, what the percentage of those folks that were involved in automobile accidents without seat belts, things like that?
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, we do not collect that information currently, although we are reevaluating the data because we do know that there's a wide range. Some of them are the car accidents without seat belts. Some of them are, as we've been asked in the past, some not wearing a helmet, riding a motorcycle. So there are some of those, as well as there are some other injuries that occur certainly with people. So that is not data we currently can report out.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, I know percent of poverty level is a significant part of eligibility. Do we have any of our programs that perhaps have a higher percent of poverty level than the federal minimum?
Ms. Green?
Madam Chair, Representative Stewart, no, we do not. We Wyoming is a very, very frugal program. We cover the minimum necessary, and we have not expanded income levels on any of our programs.
Thank you.
You were asking population-wise whether, as a percentage of the population in Wyoming, do we have a higher level of people that would qualify when compared to other states just because of the demographics of income throughout Wyoming?
Madam Chair, Senator Nicholas, I don't believe we know that information. Certainly we could look for it. My instinct would be no, we don't.
Senator Meyer.
Madam Chairman, looking at the proposition of maybe limiting some of the costs, I noticed we have a couple that are well over $100,000. Would it be possible to limit the costs that the state puts out on Medicaid to an annual rate of $100,000 a year or something like that along those lines and still maintain our maintenance effort?
Madam Chair, Senator Meyer, I believe you would have to be in a capitated rate type program with some kind of risk management underwriting for that. As far as costs for children go, no. We, by agreement with the federal government, are required to pay for whatever is medically necessary for children. We do set rates in this state for all of our providers. Some of those are based on Medicare rates. Most of them are cost-based. So we do try to contain costs. But as far as capping costs, no, I don't believe we can do that under our state plan.
And, Chairman, that's just really under the disabled or the nursing homes. That's the only two places where it gets over $100,000 a year. And I could see ABI and disabled. I'm just trying to figure out how we get $129,000, $130,000 in nursing home expenses for a client. I guess I don't know that much about nursing homes. Could you? Is it all met?
Madam Chair, Senator Meyer, we have pulled those top 100 cases to have an in-depth look at them. What I would tell you is there are certain clients in the nursing facility setting that are perhaps ventilator dependent. We have to pay additional funding to those facilities to take care of those clients. They're what we call extraordinary care clients, and we pay for them in addition to what the standard per diem rate is for the facility.
Good. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Green, while you're up there, on your page 6 graph, which box would Medicaid births be under? Is that the top 5% or is it under adult?
Madam Chair, Representative Esquivel, Medicaid births would fall into two different places, perhaps three different places, maybe even four different places. If it's a normal birth, you would have a child who would be immediately eligible because the mother was eligible. And then the mother would be covered also. If the child was born with problems at birth, they would probably end up in a neonatal intensive care unit, and those costs, of course, would be significantly higher. And if there was any complications with the mother, that mother could also fall into a higher cost group.
So, Madam Chair, that they're all over the place then. Okay. Do you have any idea how much we're spending outside the state of Wyoming on the NICU now? I asked you that last year. It was around $20 million. Has that gone up?
Madam Chair, Representative Esquivel, I don't have that off the top of my head, but I probably do have it with me today and could let you know.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Terry. Okay. Mr. Forsland? I think we can continue.
Madam Chairman, if you go to page number 7 is next, is the Public Health Division. As I said, Dr. Wendy Braun serves as in a dual capacity. She's not only the senior administrator, but she's the state health officer. The public health functions include EMS, emergency preparedness, chronic disease prevention and management, epidemiology, disease outbreak, maternal health, WIC, children's health, public health nursing, and health lab. But these functions were scattered throughout the agency. They have been restructured it into a traditional public health agency. Typical public health agencies are separate agencies within other states. Wyoming is too small of a state to separate, and certainly would drive up administrative costs. So that's the public health. And moving on, the next one is behavioral health, which is page 8. The functions include mental health, substance abuse, and developmentally disabled, plus two state-owned facilities, and not only owned it but operated, the State Hospital and the Life Resource Center.
Okay, and yes?
On behavioral health, I noticed when I renewed my health insurance this year, the ACA Act required a mental health component to health insurance, and I'm just wondering whether or not, because of that mental health component in all insurance now, whether or not we could expect any type of a income off of regular insurance policies that would come back to the state in any of these programs that we have.
Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, that's certainly an interesting question that we have discussed within the agency. Not so much for generating income, But as at the advent of the ACA and the requirement that health insurance will have to pay for mental health services, question is, does the state continue to allocate the same amount of money to local community mental health facilities, because they will have additional revenue coming in that wasn't there before? But again, that's going to be a public policy call that the legislature will have to make, to say, since additional, you're getting additional money here, you don't need as much from the state.
Madam Chairman, I think that's one of the reasons I asked it, because I recall when we had a discussion about going to socialized mental health program in the state of Wyoming, which we have now, do we do that or do we use the private insurance model and mandate mental health? Well, we chose not to mandate mental health, but the federal government has made that decision for us. So now the question is, and I think it's aptly stated, is that do we pull the plug on all these mental health things and let them be funded in the private sector model? So I think, Madam Chairman, I think the director is on top of it, and I thank you for being on top of it, and I look forward to maybe a discussion maybe next year where we can pull the plug on some of these things.
Okay, go ahead.
Director, if you're going down to the bottom of the page 8, on House Bill 91 and Senate File 76, those were the are those the substance abuse bills, or what bills are those that caused that significant?
That's the mental health and substance abuse, and that's the initiative that Senator Meyer was talking about that you all took on a few years ago.
And the, below that, you've got three schools, and you're citing 2102706. Which statute was that? That's the one where we provided for subsidies to preschools, is that, or what is that?
Right.
Madam Mr. Chair and mm-hmm. Mr. Co-Chair, statute requires us to prepare exception requests based upon increase in child count in the preschools, and also requires us to prepare an exception request for including an external cost adjustment similar to the public schools for the individuals that work in the in these developmental centers across the state.
And, Mr. Chairman, we have a handout number 150 with that information.
Chairman, I mean, what's happening, I mean, what the director's pointing out is each one of these statutes, mm-hmm. frankly, was the product of the creation of a select committee to address each issue. So every time we create a select committee, whether it's mental abuse, substance abuse, select committee on this and that, those select committees each time come back with bills that increase the significantly the contribution to these centers. They identify a problem, and we apply money to solve it. But, I mean, we... one of the things that would be interesting is to, maybe you, if you've already done it, if you took out each one of these areas where we have new dollars and a House bill or Senate file, do you already know, I mean, could you create as easily a table that would say the program, the money, the bill, and then identify the select committee that was assigned to that task? We can do it ourselves if you...
Madam Chairman, Senator Nicholas, I'm not sure.
I wonder if, going back, Bill Mai, if could we assign to one of our staff, one of our research staff, to go through and I pull out all of these, each one of these areas where you have a House bill, Senate file. They've already done some of the work, the dollar amount, and then just attach the select committee that was responsible for that. I think there's a pattern here, and we just need to identify that pattern.
Good.
So, I mean, I assume that we're going to get some health stuff from some of your stuff, too, but and maybe on your – but let's see if we can't do that, and that is identify these, each one, the cost, the amount, and then the select committee involved. And it's a point to be made to ourselves as well as to our colleagues that there's, if we create select committees to become advocates for program expansion, they're pretty good at it.
Representative yeah. Wallace, and then we're going to take a break.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just went through the mental exercise of trying to back way up and look at an even larger picture, and that would be, is there a way? Can we figure out if our increased spending on mental health and substance abuse is any kind of correlation to our decrease in the number of kids winding up in the boys and girls schools? In the corrections department, just a day or so ago, we were hearing about a decrease in that population. And so where are we? Is there a correlation? And if so, how do the dollars balance out if you're paying on one end or the other end in the long run?
Okay. With that, we'll take a 10-minute break. Be back at whatever that is, 9:35. All right, let's pull it together now that we've had our 20-minute break. All right. Mr. Porcelain, if you would like to start back up.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I was just beginning the Behavioral Health Division, and I went through the different components, which was mental health, substance abuse, and developmentally disabled. And then there's two state-owned and operated facilities, which is the State Hospital and Life Resource Center. As I mentioned earlier, Chris Newman is leading this division. And one thing, observation I had when I came into the department that I was quite surprised at, and probably I shouldn't have been, but there's been a significant state financial commitment to behavioral health issues in recent years. If you include the developmentally disabled or DD waiver costs along with the mental health costs, the state of Wyoming spends approximately the same amount supporting in this, I'm talking general funds, spends about the same amount in behavioral health as it does in the Medicaid program, approximately $500 million the same or for each of them. Finally, I was surprised at how much we end up paying for things like out-of-home placements. Just for out-of-home placements, this biennium, we incur approximately $100 million in Medicaid costs for out-of-home placements that are handled through DFS. Moving on, page number 9.
Or, Director, before we go out of there, one of the things that I'm curious about with on those analyses, I'll finish my notes here. When the select committee did the mental health substance abuse, they identified deficits throughout the state. They provided a mechanism to provide those services throughout the state. Is the cost associated in part with our desire to create provide services and essentially fund services that aren't being delivered? For example, if you say, okay, we're going to have mental health services covered in this area of the state, the population doesn't have enough people there to warrant a mental health care provider, so we're going to pay for the provider to go there, but the provider is only 50% utilized, and we're paying for that downtime. Or is there, did I explain that well? And I guess part of it is part of the cost and the excessive cost or the high cost in part because of the way we constructed the delivery system?
Madam Chairman, Senator Nicholas, the plan that was put together back when the select committee worked on it was to, the concept was go to more of a regional system where there would be community mental health centers located strategically around the state, and the state then would provide funding to support those facilities. And then people wouldn't have to drive to Casper or to a Cheyenne, but they would have services in more of a regional setting. The state has gone into a contracting mold where it contracts with these regional systems, regional centers, and they provide the services to the people on an as-need basis. And so that's the way the system was set up, and that's the way it's operating today. One of the things that's not quite directly to your question, but I think it begs it, is that as the state has been putting more and more funds into these community mental health centers, is what has been the return on the investment? And I've asked the association that oversees or not oversees, but works with the different community mental health centers, that question is that we more than doubled the amount of state money going into your operations. You know, what are we seeing as a result of it? And what we need to, in my opinion, is to get better outcome measures on exactly what are we getting for the money that are investing in all these facilities. We've been working with, again, the WAMSAC organization over the course of this last year to develop better performance indicators to see if, in fact, are we getting what are we getting for our money.
That sort of on the what are we getting for our money brings me to the other question. We've talked about, and we talked about a little bit earlier, and that is as we've constructed our system and the number of folks that are getting benefits, our total cost, is it comparable to other states? And I guess what I'd like to do is ask your staff, if they can, is to give us sort of a comparative of the cost per capita. And see whether or not our cost per capita is appropriate, and then maybe the cost as a percentage of our general fund and budget reserve budgets. And I guess part of the something that still makes me wonder, and that is our capacity to pay limited more because of our taxing system, and we don't have an income tax, and so that per capita we're not paying any more than other states are, but as a percentage of our budget is a higher percentage because we have generally lower budgets than other states do per capita. I don't know how to translate that, but it seems to me that as we're beginning to say what is an appropriate amount of health care dollars for us to pay for this population, and you're comparing us, you say, well, if you compare our waiver programs, we're very stingy, if you will. Other states have more waiver programs. We're administering our programs leaner than other states, but the real question I still have then is, as a percentage of their budgets, what are their percentage of their budgets for health, these programs, and what is the dollar per capita, so we can put some of that information together to try to figure out if it turns out that we just don't want to pay taxes and this is an appropriate level of care, that's one discussion. If we're saying, look, as a percentage of our budget, as per capita spending, these dollars are out of control, we need to have that discussion too. Is that something you think you can help us on, or is it too much of a task?
Madam Chairman, Senator Nicholas, certainly we can take a look at that. We are doing some similar type analysis in this regards in terms of comparing our costs to other states and to not only the public sector but also some private sector areas, and I'll show you that a little bit later. But certainly can try to provide some information to the committee in that regards.
My only caution is, and it's not a caution, but request is that as you're doing that, your staff said, look, you know, here's per capita charges, here's percentage of your total budget charges, and sort of get a feel for that because, we all know that we have an unusual tax system as compared to our other states. So we have to look beyond that to say, okay, if we're not raising enough taxes to deal with this population, and that's a discussion to be had. If, on the other hand, we're raising plenty of taxes and per capita we're high on our cost, either because our health care delivery system is more expensive or for other reasons, we need to have that discussion as well. I know that it's more challenging, but we do need to have a higher level of discussion.
Madam Chairman, also along that same line is the we have a tremendous growth in not only the money that has gone from the state's general fund to the community mental health organizations, but there has been a lot of Medicaid money going to the same organizations. But besides those, some of the biggest growth has been particularly in the Medicaid area in terms of the mental health has been gone. Growth has gone to private mental health providers within the state. So I took a look at the number, how much we've spent over since, I think, 2000 on mental health, both state general funds as well as non-general funds, Medicaid costs, et cetera. And it's quite a large increase, put it that way, to how much it has gone up. So the question is, again, what are we getting for our return on our investment? But then secondly, is there a better model out there? And that's where we're looking at, as an example, state of Missouri right now has just implemented a new health home component, which is for mental health or behavioral health-related issues to bring together, so you don't have somebody who's going to one facility for their mental health issues, because as soon as they have mental health issues, their costs on their acute care related areas are generally 75% more expensive. You need to bring those together. So that's a longer term issue. Shorter term, we can try to get some information to at least show you what is going on and how we compare.
Chairman, I guess your staff is here, and I guess it's probably appropriate to have sort of the 10,000 foot looking down. But if we're $50 million under budget right now, or over budget, which we are, the governor's now, $50 million underwater, we only have two choices. We can cut our operating budget, and the only operating budget in the governor's budget that has this level of new request is your agency. I think you've got $70 million plus. No other agency has the capacity to absorb $50 million. The other option is to remove capital construction dollars, which frankly creates more of a problem, because these capital construction projects, the state is the largest builder in the state. So if we're not building buildings and highways, those people don't have jobs, and they're back on your rolls. And so there are families out there depend on these jobs, but those are the only two places we can cut. And the discussion that we'll end up having as we go by age or item by item is that if we flatline you, that means that your ability to control your cost is essentially lower provider reimbursement, freezing COLAs, and essentially freezing everybody till we sort this out. We keep the waiting lists where they are, and some instances they grow. And we know that you can do that, and we know there's an impact on it, and we know that we'll be hearing from the healthcare community, particularly the hospitals and the doctors, about reimbursement levels. But, folks, this is the discussion, and my assumption is that if we send you out with the exact budget you have and no exception requests, you can run your organization. There's still $1 billion going out into the healthcare community. It's just not $1.2 billion or whatever.
Madam Chairman, Senator Nicholas, you're absolutely correct. You will give us the money that we can spend, and whatever you give us, we will live with. I have no problems with saying that. Now, will there be impacts? Absolutely, there will be impacts, and you'll hear about it. It'll come from the healthcare industry representatives who will express their concerns. I think we can absorb a number of expenditures within our budget if you'll give me some flexibility to better manage this this budget as we go through, and we won't have the negative impacts. I can't get you $50 million, but I can get you over $10 million, if not more. But you got to give me some flexibility.
What flexibility are you looking for, and what specifically what would you be?
Madam Chairman, Senator Nicholas, I mean, I can go through some of the things now, or I can hold it as we go to that particular item. But as an example, I can't use 100 series savings for non-100 series related usages. And I've got some significant savings I can achieve if I can use that money instead of for salaries, putting it over on contracting for services. And so there's a request in the budget for some positions that, frankly, I don't need. But I can't take that money and move it out. So I want that discussion in a couple different places today as we go along through the budget.
Well, I'll tell you what, we'll make a list here as we're going through. But let's take the 100 series. We put the restriction on 100 series because vacancies and the use of vacancies was used as a tool to for flex, and folks were holding on to positions they really didn't need. My view of it is that, and I don't know if my colleagues share this view, but to the extent that you say, look, we have 100 series vacancies that we're prepared to give up to move over there, it's okay to give up your vacancies, I think, in general, and move the money into other programs as long as you give up the vacancies. But if you're holding if you're holding your FTE count high to create excess revenues, but you want to keep your FTE counts there, that's the problem that we have, because that's the misuse we were trying to avoid. But to the extent that you say, look, we'll give up FTEs and we don't need to have this vacancy pool, so we'll give up the money and move it, that's a discussion I think we've always been willing to have. What we're unwilling to do is say you keep your FTE count, create a slush fund for you to flex in and out so that we're, in effect, paying for positions that you know you'll never fill, and that's where you're picking up your slush funds. So as long as you deal with our issues, we're always willing to talk about moving funds from 100 series to other series.
Madam Chairman, Senator Nicholas, we'll have those discussions as we go through, and I understand what your concerns are, and I hope to alleviate some of your concerns.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To back up just a little bit again back to mental health, I think all of us have struggled with that question on deliverables and how do we measure success? How do we know when we've attained that? And I'm remembering some of the debate back from Senate File 76. I remember that we were looking for that better model than what we had at the time. And what we had, we were relying heavily, I guess, on Evanston and some of our more intensive ways to manage this for our citizens. And it occurred to me that perhaps you should have those numbers as far as are we diverting people away from there with this more community-based effort. So do you know if you've seen any numbers that would reflect success in that regard?
Madam Chairman, Representative Stewart, unfortunately, we do not have those numbers today. Hopefully a year from now we will. We're building in new performance measurements into the contracts that are going out for this next year. And we are trying to simplify it and put it down to ultimately a list of indicators to that the average person would understand and would expect to know. As an example, a list of indicators for mental health is a person staying away from involvement with law enforcement? Do they have a place to live versus homeless? Are they employed or not? I mean, those type of pretty simple, but I think indications that somebody's being successfully treated or not. If we end up with a person who's got continued problems with law enforcement and is ending up through emergency detention or is ending up at the state hospital, it's not being very successful versus somebody who's been at the state hospital who now they are a local community mental health center is working with them and trying to keep them back out of the state hands, then that to me is a success. And you can, I've looked at a lot of indicators that are so esoteric in nature that I just don't think it makes much sense. We need to have them simple enough that the average citizen can say, yes, that's a good use of our money or not a good use of our money. So we're moving towards, again, more a concept of performance contracting is we'll give you this much money, this is what we want in return, and hopefully we'll have a better list of outcome measures and truly outcomes that I can show you in a year or two than I do today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I mean, we hear this regularly, frequently, you know, how long will it take to get, you know, significant data, statistically significant data? It is always elusive. And again, it seems like we try to change horses in the middle of the race. So, I mean, to the extent that funding could diminish before we have data, would that be a good direction to take, Director? Or maybe phrase it a different way, should we maintain a certain level of funding until we have some statistically significant data to measure our successes?
Madam Chairman, Representative Stewart, that would certainly be a decision that the policymakers would need to make, and that would be the legislature in that case. Whether you give us more money, keep it the same, or decrease it, I still think this type of performance contracting and measuring, basically trying to measure return on investment is something we need to go towards regardless of the funding amount.
To follow up on that, I mean, if you turn back to page 7 of your budget, the bottom line is that you're asking for, in all your programs, a $51 million. Well, you asked for $72 million. The governor reduced you to about $51.7, about $52 million. Is that right? Of general funds.
That's correct.
And when you look at that as a percentage increase to your budget, what's that percentage? What a percent of increase does that result in?
Mr. Peck?
Madam Chair and Mr. Co-Chair, of general fund, that would be around a 10% increase. Overall funding, it would be a little bit less than 5%.
Well, but if you did overall funding, you'd have to add in the general fund, too. Then you would, I mean, the federal dollars. So you can't take, I assume that if you add in overall funding, you got to add your federal and your general. And then are you still at 10%, or is it only 5%?
It's still approximately 10%.
Okay, all right. Give me a break. Okay. So it's a 10% increase, and then of general fund, and it's also a 10% increase of total funds.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
And now, here's another concern. And when you, Director, when you've given us these breakdown by pages, it's great, but one of the things that we're not seeing is that would be helpful is if you had these things and figure out which of these categorical areas what the percentage increase is. So if you're looking for a 10% increase in your total budget, we know that not every category is a 10% increase. And so if we're seeing, for example, in behavioral health, a 30% increase, in some places a 10% interest or increase, so that's a breakdown that would be helpful for us just for this year. And Bob, you may already have that stuff. To just provide us in the same categories you have here what the dollar increase is and what the percentage by category in, so that we can show our colleagues what the and I tell you, if it would be helpful to have the percentage increase that you requested and the Gov's Rec percentage.
Mr. Chairman?
I mean, if the Gov's Rec is 10%, your percentage is going to actually be closer to 12 or 13%, I would assume.
Mr. Mai?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I thought it was Mr. Chairman today. Phil, I need to point out two things to you about that page 7, that those numbers for general fund on page 7. Essentially, that $21 million reduction in the Gov's Rec column, that's that WLRC.
Okay,
primarily, so that's at WLRC number.
So the requested money is going to be closer to $72 million.
Correct, Mr. Chairman.
So and 70, at $72 million, it's going to be more than 10%. Do you know, you
Mr.
got that
Chairman,
calculated in your mind?
Mr. Brown? Chairman, I'm doing that, and I hate to come to the aid of the Department of Health because it's, you know, it's not my job, but I'm looking at $72 million versus 900 million, I'm thinking I've come up with more like 7%.
How much 7%?
Yeah.
7% total budget, and then the question is what happens when you start breaking it out on items. So let's do this. I mean, what I'd like to have is a spreadsheet that shows the correct number is the $72 million. Are we going to get a new page 7, or what are we going to do?
Mr. Chairman, first of all, I don't think there's an error on page 7. I think page 7 is correct.
It's the revenue for, or is the
it's the way it was profiled. Again, I think Department of Health's numbers are right through this budget. You have to dig into the details to really understand the implications of that fund shift, first of all, because the way it has to be entered into the budget system is that it does show a reduction of general fund appropriation. What it doesn't show is a reduction of general fund revenue that goes along with that.
But it was Medicaid federal government revenue. It was Medicaid reimbursement revenue.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. But
all right.
And in answer partially to your second question about a summary and where is this money at, there actually is a really good summary, I think, in this budget, and it begins on page 10. And that shows you the exception request. Now that's just the request. What you need to put with that is what the Gov's Rec is.
Okay, so then you could do it by program. We want to see percentage. But now let's go back to page 7. Under your example, why, if the general fund line is the same, why shouldn't the X line, other essential, or the federal dollars would be reduced by the $21 million. Because that's not profiled on this sheet. I mean, that your federal dollars, all the federal dollars for your program should report it on this sheet. And if you're telling me that we expect to see $21 million less from the federals, why wouldn't that show up on the X line?
Madam Chair, mm-hmm. Mr. Co-Chair, it's because I am wrong about that. That is a governor's reduction in that column. That number just jumped off the page at me as being that WLRC number, but it actually isn't. That would be in the total exception request.
Well, this sheet does have to. I mean, that should show up on this.
Yeah.
Unless you have off-profile revenues
right.
and expenses.
Right. Both those numbers should be in there.
All
in,
right. So we need a new page 7.
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, I do believe it's correct. I think it's just that $21 million shift actually is reflected in those numbers in column 4. It's already there.
But it didn't make it to the goldenrod.
half of it didn't make it to the golden round, Madam Chair. The revenue half of it.
All right. Well, so we're going to blame it on Brett. Okay. You guys just skated this one. Okay. All right. Going back then, once we agree on the profiles, we ought to have, we need the exercise of having a spreadsheet that shows what percentage increase of both general fund and federal funds is being requested by the exception request that you've made and the Gov's rec. And then we also need to have that broken down by category so that we can see if one program is asking for a 30% increase and one's asking for zero. I mean, your director's office is not asking for a 10% increase, I don't think. But some other programs are asking for more than 7 or 10, whichever it is. But I just like to have those built for, those charts built for. And I think you've done them for us in the past, Bob.
Mr. Peck.
Madam Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, I actually have a spreadsheet that ties all of that out. So I just need to add the percent. I just need to add the percentages. So I can add the percentages to this, and maybe I'll put it on bigger paper so somebody can read it.
When are you going to give us your spreadsheet that you usually give us?
But it's actually in the version's in the packet, but it doesn't have the governor's rec in here. Because I couldn't figure out how to get it in that packet in portrait, so it would be legible. I could finish this up tomorrow.
That'd be great.
You know, when
Thanks.
I get back, provided we're done.
Yeah, and then what? In fact, if you just email, and that one you might just email it to us with. That's in an Excel spreadsheet, or
it's in an Excel spreadsheet.
So you just email it to us in that spreadsheet, and we can read it, and our staff will have it.
Terrific.
Okay, let's continue. Your mic.
Excuse me. Page number 9 is the aging division, which includes senior services, licensing and surveys, and then 3 state-owned and operated facilities, Pioneer Home, Retirement Center, and the Veterans Center. Now, just real briefly, I wanted to show you just what we were doing in terms of the new performance systems being implemented. One is monthly operational reports. I wanted to turn your attention to an item that I wanted in the packet, but it didn't get in, so I passed it out this morning. It's 151. This just shows you an example of operational reports we put into place and how we're using them. This is the state hospital and shows for December. And we're looking at things as an example. The number of, if you take a look at the average waiting list, which is in the middle of the page, and we're looking at average days waiting. The previous month it was at 18, and now it's at 10. So essentially what this means is we have people around the state waiting to get into the state facility, the state hospital, and we're having to pay for those for those people to be housed in other locations. And you see where last month we had $271,000 in expense. This last month it was $178,660 that we paid. So we're trying to monitor that to see how we can try to get those costs down, that waiting time down, so we can drive those costs down. Another example is if you take a look at down under operational costs at the bottom of the left of the page and the left-hand corner there, it says cost of care per patient day. And the current month it says 941. Last month it was 1,020. We feel that is too high. We're benchmarking ourselves against, again, other state facilities around the country, as well as our other private providers within the state. And there's a variety of reasons why our costs seem to be higher. Part of it, I think, is structural because of the buildings that we have and the campus layout. Part of it has just to do with how we operate operate the facilities. We're trying to drive the cost down. So that's just an example of from the operational reports. Second one is health stat, which is on page number 11 and 12. This is patterned after Maryland state stat and New York City Comstat, and we had used it with the city of Casper. Essentially, it's a tool that we're using to evaluate the performance of programs within the department. We have, as you saw at the beginning, 95 or give or take programs within the department. So how do we go about evaluating the performance of those those programs? We need to do it in a more systematic way, more measurable way. So we've put together a program where we're trying to take a look at, if you take a look at page 12, the inputs, basically the staffing and the expenditures, and then the outputs, and then the efficiency measures, and then the outcomes. Basically, is it achieving what the original intent of the program is? So this is just an example, again, of the performance that we're trying to initiatives bringing in within the department. Moving on to status of the current 11-12 budget, wanted to let you know, remind you that the department started with a $21 million general fund deficit in Medicaid. It was basically because of an overrun from 9-10. So we began the year with a $21 million deficit in Medicaid. Then in we had $49 million in ERA funding that ended on 7 July of last year. Essentially, this was temporary funding that went away. So we lost that $49 million in federal funds as of last July. However, at this point, we estimate that we'll end the year with about a $9 million general fund deficit in Medicaid. So we've come a long ways from where we began, but we're still at around that $9 million number. However, we hope to bring the total state budget, department budget, in under the authorized appropriation, which hopefully we can make up that shortfall and not have to have any additional appropriation for the budget.
Hold on, Madam Chairman. I guess it's going forward for this year. There's no way for us to know what this committee is going to recommend yet and then what the legislature recommends. But if we recommend lower than requested amounts, at some point it's our expectation that you'll trim your burn rate so there's no deficit. And if that means, as you pointed out, that means that if we send you out with less money than you've asked for, and you're required to look at your reimbursement rates, trim them, and do those things, and it does have an impact, and providers begin to contact us, that's the consequence that happens, and we'll have to accept that. But at some point, it seems, you know, you get to this issue, you can predict where you're going to be, and you can hit whatever revenues we give you. The idea is to trim your expenditures to meet, at the end of the biennium, your profile, and I'm glad it's only $9 million, but still a $9 million deficit. And I guess the discussion then is how do we stop, if you will, the practice of having a burn rate that results in a deficit?
Madam Chair, Senator Nicholas, it's a good question. And when I came into the department, I found it interesting is you start the year $20 million in the hole. And you say, okay, here's your appropriation, but it's $20 million short, and start from there. And it's, remind me of, the old thing is selling your soul to the company store. I mean, you never can get out of debt. I mean, at some point you need to start from ground zero and then go from there. And so we started the year at 20 in the hole. We were saying for Medicaid it's $9 million, but for the budget for the department, it's probably going to be, we've dug ourselves out. And so, you know, talk about burn rate, it would help immensely if we didn't start the year or the new biennium in the hole. That's where we anticipate being for the next biennium. With that said, is you will give us the money that to use, and with that we'll adjust our spending accordingly. And
Madam Chairman, let's have that discussion. If we, I guess the stricter we are force you to adhere to your old budget, and I guess the issue that I use, if we're going to flatline you on last year's budget and we don't give you exception requests, the message you're saying is, look, if you're going to restrict us our growth, then you also need to start us out on zero. Which means you need, harder we are on your budget, the more you need a $9 million to pick up your deficit. Is that what you're saying?
No.
Okay.
Madam Chairman, what I'm saying is that it makes it very difficult for an agency to be given a budget and say, okay, you have $100 to spend. But when you start, you say, oh, and by the way, there's really not 100 there, there's 90. So in this case, if you're going to give us 100, give us 100, and we'll live with the 100, and we will live with it. I don't have a problem with living. I've done it a whole career. A legislative body gives a dollar amount to live with, and we live with it.
Well, I think I understand exactly. I think we are on the same page. If you look at your total request is about $52 million for general fund. And that means that if we gave you, or that's not your request, that's the Gov's rec. So the Gov's rec leaves you with about $52 million of general fund and about $69 million of new federal funds. And if we sent you out from that point, you've got to make up out of those total funds $9 million in order to bring a budget in. And so ultimately that's a total of a little over $100 million, and you're exactly right, it's about 10%. So you got to, out of that $100 million, the first you know you have to make up $10 million as you go along. And if for every dollar that we reduce below the governor's rec, you still have $9 million to make up.
Mm-hmm.
That's not going to change if that's your deficit. So the less money we give you, the higher percentage of your budget has to be made up to pay for a $9 million deficit.
Okay.
Representative Pedersen.
Madam Chair, my question for the director is, this is something that we talked about for every year that I've been on the committee, is the burn rate. And I understand when you start in the hole and you're trying to control your year-end spending. But for better understanding for our committee as we go forward, because I don't think it's just about making up the $9 million, there's clearly a series of factors that are somewhat must be out of your control that are affecting the burn rate to have it come in year over year at various deficits. And I'd like to have a better understanding so that the committee can see how this works. What are factors that are out of your control that are affecting that burn rate? Because that seems to be what we discuss every year as the budget comes back.
Mr. Porcelain.
Madam Chairman, Representative Pedersen, the Medicaid program, which we're talking about here now, is living within the budget that was appropriated. In fact, what I was saying is it would be running a surplus if we didn't start the biennium with $20 million that had to be paid back. So consequently, it has been going in a positive direction this last 18 months in terms of spending. Now, in terms of what controls the spending, it's essentially three things. One is the number of people on the Medicaid program. two is the type of services that the people ask for, or not ask for, but need. Three is the rates that we reimburse the providers. So, I mean, those are the kind of the factors. And, you know, we can't control the number of people coming on the program as an agency. The only people that can control a portion of that is the legislature by saying how many people are going to be on waivers. Because, again, when you talk waivers, that is Medicaid. And for some reason, a lot of legislators think that you got Medicaid and you got waivers. They're not the same thing. They are the same thing. And but other than the waivers, you know, the rest of the people on the program, those are by right. And so if they meet the qualifications, they get to be on the program. So there's nothing you can particularly control there. In terms of the services they have of need, you know, they are allowed to get them. And, you know, the question is how can you better deal with those? There's lots of things that we're looking at in terms of changes, but those are longer term in nature. The last is provider rates, and rates are reimbursements, and those things that you can turn on a dime almost, relatively speaking, and you can reduce or adjust the amounts that you pay reimburse providers for. And that's what the department has had to deal with when it had to deal with cuts in the past.
Follow up question. Okay, good. Senator Meyer.
Tom, what percentage is provider reimbursement to total costs?
100%.
The program, the Medicaid program. No, it's not 100%. It's got to be like. Well, you've got your overhead.
Approximately 95%.
Approximately 95%.
Okay.
So I guess if you just do the simple math, if you wanted to reduce 10%, you reduce your provider rates by 10%, and you're 9.5% there as far as reducing your total costs of your program. Would that be a simple formula?
Pretty simple.
Okay.
Go ahead.
And I appreciate that. The concern that, going back to the answer that you gave to Senator or Representative Pedersen, so you've got, say, I got three variable factors. I've got number of persons, type of services, rates of reimbursement, and I'm starting the hole with $20 million. I can't remember a time that we sat in the beginning of the biennium and budgeted a deficit. And it's not our intent now to budget for a deficit. So the deficits that arose were arose by management on rates of reimbursements or whatever variable factors you have. And on top of that, you took in, what was the total ARRA funds you took in over the biennium?
$49 million for this biennium.
So you took $49 million. Now I understand, Director, there's a difference between your watch and the prior watch. But from the committee's point of view, we budgeted an amount at the beginning of every biennium, and then halfway through the year we're told, oh, by the way, you now have a $20 million deficit. If you don't give us money, we're going to run out on April because our burn rate's X amount of dollars, and if you want to have Medicaid services between April and July, you're going to have to provide us more money. And the frustration I've always had is that if you come to me in the middle of the year or towards the end of the biennium and said we have run our programs with these variable factors to achieve a $20 million deficit, that's not what we budgeted. So ultimately, Department of Health, they know what their budget is. That is, you got to have a burn rate you predict to get to a balanced budget. I know it's tough, but what we see is that it doesn't make any difference what we appropriate to you. You burn at a rate that's comfortable and then come to us with a deficit. Not you, but our predecessors. And that's why you arrived at a $20 million deficit. How do we avoid that?
Madam Chair, Senator Nicholas, it's a good question. Is how do you control a cost of a program? And in a way that is acceptable to the constituents, the citizens of the state. You've got a number of viewpoints in terms of, first of all, what is the intent of this program? Is the intent of the program to be a safety net for the lowest income people of the state, or does it go beyond that? And in the state of Wyoming, this program has grown beyond a safety net for the lowest income folks of the state. But you have a number of variables that happen during the course of a year that are totally beyond the control of a department in terms of what is happening in the economy. I find it absolutely fascinating trying to look at this program and saying, you know, how do you better run it to address all the different interests that the people in the state have and who are expressing their opinions. And if the issue is simply cost, we can cut 25% out of Medicaid just like that. And you would take away the optional services that the legislature has said we want to add. Okay, 25% over $1 billion is some big bucks, but there's going to be tremendous impact on that and ramifications. So if people say, oh, no, now that's off limits, so don't touch that, and don't touch this and don't touch that, then ultimately the department it becomes more and more of a challenge on how best to administer this thing. And so the department is doing the best it can. Can we improve? Absolutely, we can improve. We're seeing a number of areas that we can make improvements on. But I'm not going to sit here and say today that the department has done a bad job running the program by any means, because I see a lot of hardworking people and they're doing what they think is best for the citizens of the state, and I happen to agree. But I think we can improve it. But again, we need to understand. I mean, I was at a committee meeting recently, and I spent about 3 hours talking about the Medicaid program and what we need to do to tighten it down and make it as efficient and effective as possible. And the very next, and particularly cost related, and the very next item on the agenda, the committee added $28 million on a bill to the Medicaid program. And so it's I'm kind of getting whipsawed here at times by some of the same people.
Senator Nicholas.
Chairman, I'll tell you what, I'll accept the legislative. We'll all accept our legislative blame that comes with this. But I'm trying to imagine, I mean, at the end of the day, whatever, when we leave in March, things are cast in stone. At that point, you've got programs, you've got funding, and you know, absent exceptions in the next supplemental budget, what you have to operate on it. And I'm imagining you're sitting there trying to fly this jet, and you're trying to, or actually more like a big airliner, and trying to land it in the positive side of your budget in 2 years from now, and you've got a bunch of variables, including increased enrollment, that you don't know how to anticipate. Obviously, if you have declining enrollment and you've got more proceeds, you might find yourself one day in a situation where you're swimming in money because you got more money budgeted and you got your enrollments cut in half. Unlikely to happen, but it could. But as I'm imagining, and I wonder if part of the question is your reorganization addressing this? But if you've got one employee that says, hey, look, our enrollment's going up 5-10%, and you've got another employee up there that's saying, has got providers calling in every day and saying, "You're killing me. I need, I can't do that service for $100. It's going to take $120." And that provider is looking at a picture of what they can charge, and maybe that person doesn't realize. I mean, if you know your enrollment's going up 10%. You may have to say, not only, doctor, not only you're not going to get $100, but you're only going to get 90. And then, of course, they come and complain to us, and that's fair game. But ultimately, that's the tough decision. I mean, I'm kind of saying, if that's the choice, make it. And if they come to us and we don't, and we want to fund the more money, then that's, you force that decision on us. But if you don't make that decision to say, look, we're going up 10, now we got to drop the provider rate by $10 to hit the to keep our burn rate in our forecast, then you come to us and said, look, it's too late for you to be involved. You have a $20 million deficit. And, you know, look, at any given time, if you make the tough decisions and there are screaming providers, and they come to the legislature and they give you more money, that's the process. And I'm okay. I can live with that. What I have a hard time living for is if you're making the political decisions to say, we don't want to hear screaming providers, so we're not going to cut those, and then we end up with a deficit at the end of the year that we didn't participate in. And I know this airliner is bigger than that when it lands, but generally speaking, Senator Meyer is trying to say it's easy. You know what your burn rate is. You cut your provider reimbursement to make sure that aircraft lands in the black. And if somebody screams, they come to us and we make the political decision. But you don't make it inside the agency. Does that make sense?
Mr. Forslund and then Senator Meyer.
Madam Chairman, Senator Nicholas. Yeah, it makes sense. I have no issues making those decisions. I have no issues talking to groups about the decisions. I've done it already since I've been on the job. I know you've heard some feedback about that. But I'm telling you, it's more of a challenge than you're making it out to be, but I have no problem with the message, and I have no problems with attempting to live within the budget. I have a long history of doing that, and I anticipate continuing to do it here.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I just looked at the numbers, and roughly 3.9% reduction in provider rates across the board would get you $70 million. Over your budget. So that's what you'd have to do if 95% of it is provider rates. Less than 1% would get you your $20 million. You know, so I guess if we make the decision that we don't have the money to put in this program, then I think that we come up with the math and you know, let us take the political heat and just tell all the providers, legislature said we're giving you a 3.9% reduction, and if you don't want to live with that, talk to them.
Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, conceptually, I hear where you're coming from, but I would be opposed to across-the-board cuts. What I think is that some areas probably can handle cuts more better than others. And so I think we would need to target it. I mean, we would do the cuts, but I think it'd be better to target it, protect some areas more than others.
Representative Edmonds.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, and I see Senator Meyer's point, but I'm wondering if it isn't a little more complicated than that. Have we seen any correlation, because this is fee-for-service, have we seen any correlation between decreasing the reimbursement and increasing in services? I'm just wondering if that isn't a factor. And, you know, we can cut across the board, but those are two of the three factors that you really don't have control over. And have we seen that in the past? I don't know. I don't know how often we've actually cut reimbursement.
Mr. Portland.
Madam Chairman. Representative Edmund, it is much more complex than, as you know, I mean, there's lots of things that go into, have to factor into it. couple of examples is by cutting rates, do you end up with potentially more nursing homes at risk? Secondly, if you cut rates, do you have some providers that ultimately say it's just not worth it, and so you end up with harder to find, much like Medicare, where some physicians just won't take Medicare patients, and so we don't want to be in positions where Medicaid folks only have a handful of physicians and or providers they can go to, and they have to wait, long times, because ultimately what happens there then, instead of going to a physician's office, they just go to emergency room, and that drives up the cost of another area. So there's a lot of factors that go into it, and it's much more complex than you would ever think initially.
Go ahead. Do you have follow-up? Other questions at the moment? Okay. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Director, do you have the stats or the figures on providers, where less providers agreeing to the Medicaid contracts and saying, it's just not worth it and I'm not going to do that anymore and not signing on to that agreement? Do we have those figures statewide? Are we seeing a trend of more providers saying, I don't want in this game anymore, and dentists, doctors, and I'd like to see those figures if we can get them. I'm like Representative Edmonds. I think it's a little more complicated. I hate to punish the providers. What I've been hearing, Madam Chairman, is that the rates are very, very low, and providers are starting to back out. And there we reduce the services and we accomplish what Senator Myers. But I think that's the easy way out. And I think if there's fraud going on and we need to do more on the home front with an agency, that's the approach I'd like to see. But do we have those figures on providers in the last year or two? The trend of are we getting less providers signing up?
Madam Chairman, Senator Peterson. I don't have the numbers, let's say, tracked over a period of time with me today. I'm not sure if Terry does, but in the last year or two, we have not been dropping the rates. So I don't see that as major of a problem. But I guess when you do, I was responding to cross-the-board cuts, and you hit some areas that have, are more closer to the edge than some, some providers are willing to take it at, this percentage of cost versus others. I guess I'm not being real clear here. There are some that I think are able to take a cut easier than others. And when they won't take the cuts, that's when they'll leave the program. We can get you the data over a period of time, but it's not been reported to me that we've been losing providers over the last year or two, because our rates are good enough that people want to stay on the program. However, I saw it in Casper firsthand in the Medicare area, where I would go into physicians' offices and there would be signs up there saying, "We do not take Medicare patients." And so that's what happens when you have a declining reimbursement rates, is physicians will ultimately make those calls. And we can certainly, give you data on where we are in recent years in terms of number of providers, but I don't think it's been significant. Terry, is it?
Madam Chair, no, we have not seen a reduction in providers. Madam Chair, we have not seen a reduction in Medicaid providers that's anything significant whatsoever. We have seen providers taking fewer and fewer Medicaid clients.
Well, Madam Chair, just to follow up just real quick, I understand that we haven't reduced those contracted amounts of that agreement, or the reimbursement. But what's happening is those providers' costs are increasing almost daily on insurance, on cost of medicines, on staff, on salaries and health insurance. I mean, just like any other business. So as their costs increase, that's the driving force that they're saying, this isn't keeping up, and so that's what I'm seeing out there.
Senator Nicholas.
Chairman, I guess, I mean, I understand the complexity of this because certainly if you're going to, you don't want to, what can happen is you can shift your dollars so that if you're not given primary care dollars enough, mm-hmm. then those dollars are going to get shifted to emergency room. And in the end of the day, I have complete confidence that if you budget $1.8 billion, which we are, in the end of the day, it's going to get consumed by somebody because there's somebody out there that wants $1.8 billion. But when you look at this 95-5 plan, it occurs to me looking at it, for example, that the bottom 95% should not be absorbing the same losses or the cuts as the top 5%. And that's where, I mean, that's where the complexities get in. And I assume some of these people are under plans, and how these plans get derived and how providers are able to command those kind of prices, that's where the complexity gets. And so I don't think, Director Forslund, I don't think we're at any given time, believe us, we understand the complexity because certainly you do want to drive your, it's one thing to tell the orthopod you're not going to give them as much. It's another thing if you tell the internist, because if the internist won't deliver the service, then it shifts it to the hospital. The hospital consumes the money, and then you have, and that's not a good plan. So it is complicated, and certainly at the top, you've demonstrated that where the cuts ought to be going is in that top 5%, a greater amount. So I guess at any given time, Director Forslund, I don't think any of us are trying to make this simple. But I think part of this is these open discussions that we're having is a discussion openly with you and with your staff behind you, because the staff are the ones that send the message down below, and how they send the message is important, and that they understand what our goal is. And at any given time, it's not our capacity to support your program, no matter what happens. We're at $1.7 billion for just for your entire department. So this is, I mean, it'd be hard to say that we haven't supported this program. It's the largest program. It's more than education and more than any other agencies in the state except for highways. I think the highway department spends more money than you. Other than that, it's You're the largest agency.
Why don't you continue, Mr. Forslund?
Moving on to the 13-14 budget, just internal budget direction I gave to staff as we developed was to absorb as much as possible within the existing budget, build the budget in accordance with the restructured department, which you'll see as you go through. No new staffing requests be considered, bring forward exceptions required by law, state law, state policy, federal mandates, or governor directive. Do not bring forward requests to make up loss of federal funds, with the exception of the $49 million loss for ERA funding for Medicaid. Reason I had that is I did not want to establish a precedence for asking to make up for lost federal funding. With so many Department of Health programs, again, as I mentioned, we have 95-plus programs, so many of them being federally financed. We anticipate going through this quite often in the next few years as the federal government starts to cut back, and I didn't want to set the precedence that we would be asking to make up those funds. And where possible, start to address the infrastructure issues at the state facilities. I'll skip over some of that. Essentially, the exception requests received numerous. I denied a lot more, significantly more than you see before you. However, I was surprised at some of the exceptions that I had to put in the budget that are required by state law, state policy, and example, developmentally disabled, as well as preschool rebasing. Both of them are required by statute that I have to provide an exception request. I didn't expect that. And I also presented exceptions in areas where there has been no funding appropriated for it in the past. I felt it was necessary at least to try to begin talking about trying to clean up some of these areas where there's no funding that's been appropriated in the past. Brought forward exceptions to modify personnel cost allocations. Because so many of our positions are federally funded, we have to look at them on a periodic basis to see if, in fact, how much of their work is being done at the federal level for federal programs that can be reimbursed and how much of it can't be. We went through and identified quite a large number, and so a lot of the exceptions in there are to fix basically these allocations. The net savings, though, was $750,736 to the budget. We brought forward exceptions for grant allocations. The number of new or extended grants were a result of the new ACA healthcare law, and I had desire that be transparent and basically put it on the budget so people would know that their budgets, that there are grants, and they wouldn't be basically, as we used to call them, off budget or off balance sheet spending.
Go ahead, Senator Meyer.
No, I recall some legislation, I think last year, that said something to the effect that the health department wasn't going to comply with any federal regulations or rules on ACA. And I'm just wondering, on these things that you're doing to comply with ACA, what strings are attached as far as maintenance of effort or anything like that in those regards. So it looks like we've had some fund switches, both in DFS and fund switches with you. They did a lot of fund switching in TANF. You're doing some fund switching here where we've got picking up, positions with federal funds. Just want to make sure what the other shoe is when it drops so we know.
Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, again, these are not new positions that are being created. These are simply existing positions that if it's a 50-50, in other words, 50% federal funded, 50% state funded, and they're doing 70% federal and 30% state work, we might as well get the federal funds for that 70%. And the other side is if we can't justify it, we need to correct it now as opposed to have to repay it at a later time. But in terms of new programs coming in as a result of the ACA, does it have long-term impact or strings attached to it? It's one of the things that Governor Mead has required as directors as we have submitted the grant applications is what's the long-term ramifications of these programs. And particularly his concern is that there's no expectation that if you get a two-year grant and at the end of 2 years the federal funding goes away, that there's going to be a request to come in and make up that that with state funds then. As far as we're concerned, at the end of 2 years, if the grant's gone, then the program's gone.
Go ahead.
I guess I can understand that, but I'm wondering if there's like some date and a time, like 2019, that we have to do something because we took 2 years of federal funding.
Madam Chairman, Senator Meyer, that is a very difficult question to answer in terms of the ACA has a lot of requirements that are coming down that we have to do, but it's not tied to whether we take one of the small public health grants or not. That is irrelevant. We have to do what's required under the ACA regardless of whether we take these grants or we don't take these grants.
Go ahead, Tom.
I'll just wrap it up and say thank you for letting me give these introductory remarks.
Well, he actually went through some of them, but yeah, we can go back to.
Oh, I can ask.
Yes, let's start. You want to start on page 11 when he was. But he'd already.
Yeah, 11. I mean, if you just take us. Maybe it's simple. Just take us to the pages and show us what you're. What your message you're trying to convey.
Yeah. You'd already hit on that, but just to explain it again on the management program.
Okay. Why don't you turn to page. We can start at page number 11 there. What I'm trying to do here is an example. Just take a look at the core mission. And essentially, you're looking at the core mission or the purpose or the intent of the program. You set up a program in the first place, and it's supposed to accomplish something and to eliminate some harm, to do something. And that's where you have to take a look at what the original intent of the program is, and did it come through the legislature, and is the legislation very clear on the intent of the program? Did it come through the department as generated from the department? Doesn't matter. The question is do we understand the purpose of it? So at the end of the day, do we know whether we have success or not, whether we accomplished anything or not? I think that's where you begin with this whole program evaluation thing, is what are you trying to accomplish? If you go though to the second page then, or page 12, is that this is where I think the core of the crux comes from, is first of all, what's this program taking in terms of resources? Resources are essentially people and money. So you can find out how much we're going to, how much time we're spending, how much money we're spending, and we come up with a dollar, or we come up with that information. Secondly, then we have outputs, things that we do. As an example, the first one is number of presentations, number of events related to available colorectal cancer services in Wyoming. Those are activities. But ultimately, you can have a whole list of activities, and most program managers and most people in the program area want to devote most of their time and attention and discussions on all the activities that are going on. But that's only a portion of it. The next step you have to say is, okay, you do these activities, how efficient is it? In other words, how much is it costing per activity? And, on a screening, as an example, on a colorectal screening, how much does that cost per colorectal screening? And so that's your efficiency measure. And then the last thing, and is the toughest to measure, but it's the most critical, is the outcome. Ultimately, is the outcome accomplishing the original intent of the program? And most of the time you'll have people talking about all the outputs, all the things they're doing, but at the end of the day, does it make any difference? And that's where your outcomes are, and that's where you're trying to say, okay, are we accomplishing the original intent? It's a challenge a lot of times because the original intent is fuzzy. There is not the discipline up front put into place to say, okay, this is what success looks like. And so consequently, that makes the outcome measures difficult to do, but you can still move towards that. But again, we're trying to get some type of tool in place to monitor the performance of the 95-plus programs within the department. Otherwise, you'll have a whole laundry list of activities and outputs that we do, and then you'll say, well, does it do any good? And I'll say, I can't answer that question.
And also, as you're doing these reports, then, are you looking at which programs you can eliminate based on there not being efficacy of the program?
Madam Chairman, at the end of the day, a couple of things we can evaluate is, one, the program is doing a fantastic job. Keep up the good work. too is, and actually if you had more resources allocated to it, you probably could do even better work, and that's a good outcome. I mean, a good evaluation. Secondly, you're doing a miserable job, and you need to change your strategies, basically your outputs and your strategies, in order to better achieve your outcomes. So you can change your strategies, or, you know, three, we just pull the plug on the program because it's just, you know, they tried to change their strategy, it just doesn't work, and we'd be better off taking that money internally and moving it from this program over to this high-performing program that is starving on resources, and get better outcomes over here, and no one really will notice that this one went away because it's really not having much of an impact. But otherwise, you're just making arbitrary decisions, and that's the problem I have with across-the-board cutting on things, is you just make kind of arbitrary decisions. Okay, you don't need this much, you don't need that much, but you have nothing to really back up saying, and you might be really killing a valuable program, and a program that has not been run well, is not, and it's got way too much money, doesn't make any impact on it at all. So you have to do it a little more strategic.
And do you have the programming technology and the staff to run all these programs, you know, run all the analysis on all these programs?
Madam Chairman, first of all, we're running all these programs already.
Okay.
In terms of this initiative, this is not programming. This is just simply, you can just plug this information in. It's more of a cultural change and more of a understanding. And it's just getting up and running, and it's going to take us for a while to get it through the agency. But I guess the message I'm trying to send to you all is that we are taking our performance seriously and want to truly evaluate how we're doing and learn from it to try to improve our operations.
Representative Edmonds.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I first of all would just like to commend you for this. I think it's a great approach. My question would be, I would assume in some instances the proof is in this target fit number, but that's kind of what's going to be driving everything is the target. What is your criteria around, because some of these legislative initiatives, I don't think we put targets in. And so how are you basing a target number, like, you know, say 75 toolkits to raise awareness on prostate screening?
Madam Chair, Representative Edmonds, it's a good question. And right now, those targets are being driven or being established by the program managers, and there is not a whole lot of discussion elsewhere in the agency. That's the way it's traditionally done, not only in health, but any public programs. The program managers make those decisions, and then report on essentially their outputs. And this process is designed more to provide input from higher up in the agency. So in this case, there will be discussions between the program managers and the administrators, and they will be establishing it. But then when they'll be coming in, and what happens is we're meeting periodically, and they come in and they report their performance. And then we talk to them about their targets and are they realistic. And because you can have, again, all you want in terms of targets on outputs and all this activity, but ultimately, you know, how efficient is it? And frankly, more importantly, what's the outcome? And so it's more critical in my mind to take a look at those outcome measures and determine good outcome measures for all these programs and then go back from there, as opposed to dreaming up your outputs. You know, we're going to provide, you know, we're going to do all these wonderful things over the course of the next year, but then never think about, you know, ultimately, does it have any impact on the bottom line of the program in terms of does it accomplish the core mission of the program? And that's where I want the focus is as much as possible on the outcomes. But you can't ignore how you're going to do that, and that's through the outputs, but it's the outcomes where I want to drive this. The same thing is when we go into moving towards working with vendors or providers out in the field. I want us to drive more towards outcome measures as much as possible. It's called performance contracting. It's okay. How you do it is not important to us. It's what we get at the end is what we want to pay for. And that's where we need to become more focused, in my opinion, is to become to focus on what we're getting for the money that we're investing in these programs.
Yeah, Senator Nicholas.
I'll tell you this. I think I finally am now able to articulate a concern that I've had. And the question I've asked myself is, why would we give you a 7% increase and turn around and ask for an 8% decrease? Makes no sense at all. And you're the only agency really out there that's asked for a 7% increase in light of the fact that we've asked for budget cuts at 2, 4, and 8. And what you're telling us now is that, look, if we send you out and say every legislative program that is out there shares shoulder to shoulder with all programs and there's no priority, then you've got to cut everybody pro rata, or you've got to do some marshaling of your resources without any legislative intent. If we'd say, look, you go meet with over the course of the next year with the Labor Committee, and you're called upon to make X percentage of cuts, you might, with the committee, decide that the cancer, the colorectal screening program was a great idea, but it's not rendering the type of results we want, so we're going to eliminate that program. There might be three or four other programs, and it may be the last in, first out. I don't know. But you'd be looking at cost savings and elimination. In the absence of some guidance, you're forced to assume that every program is just as important as another. And there's always one legislator or two or three or a group that were primary sponsors of the program. And if you were proposed to eliminate those, they'd say, hey, that's unfair. We need to participate. So going back to the problem, and that is there a way to give you, if we say, okay, I keep using the word flatline, we're going to flatline you from last biennium, is there a way to either make quick decisions about program elimination or delegate to the governor, for example, the capacity to eliminate total programs that you've done these analyses on and said, look, overall, you're not getting the bang for your buck. And, I mean, we've done it in the past where we said, okay, and we could do it now. We could say, okay, if we flatline you and said you now figure out how to land your airplane in the black, but you're authorized with the governor's approval to consider the total elimination of the following programs and give them a list. And then you'd be discussing on the floor a real policy issue, and that is, policy-wise, are we prepared to eliminate these programs totally before we start taking a 10% cut to the DD program or to others? And here we are, I mean, we're a week and a half away from doing our markup, but I guess if we were to say, look, if the executive branch were to say, look, as part of our arsenal, we'd like to consider the total defunding of certain programs, could you give us a list of programs that you would completely eliminate before you'd want to start having them share shoulder to shoulder? And is this one of the programs?
Mr. Forsland?
Madam Chairman, Senator Nicholas, what you're describing, what you're saying is giving, I think, more ability to agencies to manage their respective operations, but also providing the legislative, give the legislative intent or direction. And I think I would be supportive of that by certainly. And I agree with the governor when he talked about that, you know, making across the board cuts at a late time, just very quickly, is not the way to go. I've done a lot of budget adjustments in my career, and I think across the board is a lazy way to manage an organization. But to kind of get to the core of your question, I am not in a position today, and I will not be in a position in the next 30 days or 45 days to say these are the programs that need to go away, these are the programs that need to be beefed up. We're just, I mean, this is a, you call it an airliner, I call it an ocean liner. This is taking a while. It's going to take a while to turn it, and we're starting to gather data. We're starting to do this process. Given time, I'll be in a position to, you know, almost rank order my programs and be able to tell you these are the ones that I think we should be, you know, circling the wagons on, and these are the ones I think that we can give up if we have to cut. I'm not there today. We're going to get there, but we're just not there yet.
I apologize. I don't want to command all the time, but I think we're still at the issue that if what we say to, let's suppose you had not asked for $51 million or more funding, and you said, hey, look, we got a problem, it'd be an easy thing to say, okay, you have a year to come up with 4% cuts, 2 years to come up with the second 4%, so we want a total of 8% reduction in your general fund, and you meet with your oversight committee and you make these decisions, you got time. The difficulty is if we're looking at a four, let's say a 2, 4, and 8% cut, but you're asking for a 7% increase. You know, we're saying, look, I mean, and part of the reason you're saying you need a 7% increase is because you're trying to answer to the demands of all these programs we've set up. And so if we said, okay, just hold your programs the way they are, come up with 4% and 8%, you'd still want 7% to get there. And my question to you is if we say to you, your budget is flat, you're not going to get any increase, and we want to see cuts in your programs, So we're saying, okay, you're zeroed out. I mean, you're going to stay at $1.8 billion and not going to $2 billion or whatever it is. And we then direct you to come back next year with cuts, proposed cuts to get there, and then and essentially you got 2 years to get there, but we understand that you're going to make cuts. Can you do that? Or do we have to give you... This is hard to explain, but do I have to give you $51 million in order to ask for 8% cuts? Or can I start saying you're flatlined and you come up with the cuts and how to bring the ocean liner into port and you got 2 years to do it with the money you have? Am I making any sense?
Senator Nicholas, you're asking some challenging questions, and I came in at an interesting time. I mean, part of my cost increase is a result of $49 million in lost ARRA funding. So that's not an increase in terms of the budget. It's just a matter of the state was given a temporary reprieve from paying the full cost of Medicaid, that reprieve is over and it's replacing money that was there before. And so now we're saying, well, that's an increase. Well, it's an increase from this last year, but it was expenses that were there in the past before the feds picked up that for a short period of time. So for me to make up that amount, I cut $49 million just to stay the same, let alone some of the other increases that are legislative or statute require me to bring in for a request. So there's a handful of items that are driving this increase. And when you keep talking about flatlining, essentially to me that is I just lost $49 million and that I have to make up to get back to where I am today. And so that's going to be a challenge. There's no doubt about it. And instead of asking for $49 million, we asked for the $37.7 million, I believe, which was, $12 million less almost. And I thought that was a positive step. But I guess, as I told you at the beginning, I'll tell you now, and I'll probably tell you more as the day goes on, whatever amount you give us is what we will live with.
Senator Meyer.
Tom, one of the things that your predecessors have done and other departments have done is that they've looked at programs that were supported by a constituent base across the state very strongly and made the cuts there, knowing full well that money would come back into the budget, and they actually didn't make a cut in the first place except for paper for a temporary period of time until it hit the floor. And there's a couple in your budget that are basically legislative sacred cows, so to speak, and I would hope that in the process, if we go forward, that you'd realize that and not use that type of tactic. But as far as the suggestion, of using the Labor Committee to kind of ferret out some of the costs, that particular committee, I remember one time, I think we tried that, and they came back in with a tobacco tax and spending more money. So I'm not sure whether that'll actually work with the Labor Committee, but I guess we could try. But is that what happened to you the last time you were in front of them? You came in with what your budget was there, and they added $20 million on DD or something? Or what went on that? Can you flush that out a little bit?
Senator Meyer, there is a bill pending that will add $28 million to the DD program. And in terms of their first issue, we called it the Washington Monument Syndrome, where the Park Service wants to make sure that they don't get any cuts. They offer up closing the Washington Monument, which is their number one tourist attraction, knowing that it won't happen. So I always cautioned my department heads in Casper that we're not going to play that game. No Washington Monument proposals, please be brought into me, because I can see through that very quickly. City Council can see through it very quickly. In the case of JAC and the legislature, can see through it very quickly. However, one thing I have learned very quickly in my new position is I've got almost every one of these programs, these 98 programs I've got, has got a constituency. And whatever I offer up, people are going to hear about it. It's not because I don't think it's, I'm offering up because I don't think that people will touch it. It's just a matter of all my programs are that way pretty much.
I'm just thinking out loud now. I mean, if we're going to go in and we've got to make big budget cuts, maybe we ought to identify programs with the option to eliminate. I mean, folks, if you go back to the 90s when we had no money, Department of Health's budget didn't increase because there was no money, and they just learned for many, many years there weren't going to be increases. If you look at what's happened from the 90s to now, most of those increases were legislative initiatives. substance abuse, colorectal screening. Those are just two that we've talked about today and a whole bunch of other things. So we're not back in the 90s because we've got all these other programs. And the one of the things that we do is say, look, do we flatline? Do we give $51 million? Are we going to have 2%, 4%, and 8% cuts? When are they going to come? But another way to do it is to go to your to our colleagues and give a menu of programs that we could eliminate in the budget. And there are programs that were started fairly recently, and in light of budget cuts, it might be more appropriate to eliminate them entirely. And we'll find out pretty quickly whether or not we can hold a constituent, whether the, every one of these is a Washington monument. If every program is a Washington monument, then it's pretty irrelevant to have this discussion. I guess my question, I think that going back to our staff, and I'm looking at Alex because I think maybe this is charged, but let's take a look. Let's identify the last four or five programs that have gone in that, you know, like the colorectal screening, some other programs that are programs that we could give the we could either eliminate budgetarily, and how much money it would give, and just see what those programs are. At least take a look at them, and we may not choose to do it, but let's at least take a look at it and see what they are.
So, Mr. Forslund, let's go on to, we just reviewed the program management to the next component, which I think you went through the budget review with us. That was the next sheet. And the next is, which we've been requiring, is the summary of position changes, or I guess this is on the position changes, not on the vacancies that we've asked. And Mr. Peck, can you speak on that?
Yeah. Madam Chair, in your packet, what I've provided is just a summary of all the position changes. What we're doing, and you'll see this in the budget, is actually last in the 2010 session, we put all of the position changes in one place. What we found is, even though those were approved, because, again, it was a net savings to the general fund, it didn't tie to the appropriations bill. With the way the units or the divisions had to be funded. So this time around, we put one summary for each division that has a position change. So you'll have one position change request in each division, except for the director's office. Since there's only a swap of a full-time and a part-time, I put those separate in their programs. So what you have in your packet is how that looks by division as a summary. Then you have a list of every position where the funding has changed. You'll see some of these have, you know, there is an increase to general fund. Some are decreasing general fund, the net effect being a reduction to general fund. And then I have those positions broken out by division. So if you want to actually see where the positions actually fall in the divisions and which position is in the division, it is in that summary. It's also in these position numbers are also in the exception request, but I think this is a little easier to follow than the exception request.
Yeah, I looked at that and it got a little
so complex. I thought you might want some help there.
Good, thank you.
Because we have formatting issues with the bar system that sometimes makes it difficult to really follow. The next schedule in your packet is is how we allocated our exception request for IT purchases. This is all the desktops and laptops and monitors and things like that that will be 4 years old in the next biennium. And per OCIO policy, we included an exception request to replace those. So this breaks it out by unit.
And that's starting on page 22.
That starts on page 22. And there are three pages there. The next information provided is a summary of 600 series contracts by type of service. So you'll see here that the Medicaid, it goes from the most expensive 600 series service down to the least. You can see most of it's driven our Medicaid expenditures at the top. But that's the type of service that we're providing in 600 series and what the total cost is.
Hey, that's on page 25.
That's on page 25. I'm sorry, I probably should say
are
that.
Are there any questions on the...
You know, with that list, it's a great list, but what you don't have is the Medicaid dollars, which dwarf this. The Medicaid and drugs. Can you do this? Is it possible to do a similar list with your Medicaid categorical? Or maybe you already have it.
Madam Chair and Mr. Co-Chair, I think what you're asking me to do is just break out the Medicaid separately.
Yeah, with the drugs versus
I can do that.
Medical care. Maybe if you can give major groups for,
right.
You know, hospitals, drugs, doctors, I don't know.
Madam Chair and Mr. Chairman, this information actually, this is by budget unit, and so what happens is in adult mandatory services, that would include physicians, hospitals, any services received by adults. In mandatory services children, that would include any service received by a child, and that includes prescription drugs.
Mm-hmm.
If you go down to budget unit 470 further down, you'll see that includes prescription drugs for adults, but it includes all other services that are optional that we've added to the state plan.
Madam Chair, it's helpful. With the Medicaid, I wonder if you can give us some list that's readily available, the breakdown that show us where the dollars are, which I assume will show the highest dollars going now out to drugs, and then maybe not. What's the high amount?
Go ahead, Madam Chairman. Senator Nicholas, we break it out by, you know, the recipients and break it down by the individuals and who gets it. On the other side, we break it down by providers. And then we have a listing from top to bottom on providers. So on the providers, the number one grouping is the waivers at for this last year is $120 million. Second largest was hospitals. Third largest is nursing homes. Fourth is physicians. And fifth is pharmacy.
Well, to the extent that you've got those kinds of lists that really show us who the constituency base are, those are always helpful for us.
Okay.
What did you say fifth was again?
Pharmacy.
Madam Chair and Mr. Coder, just to be clear, this will be off our this data comes from our MMIS system,
right,
which are just claims that are processed. So there are some transactions, and this schedule that I provided you comes off the WOLF system, so it was actually paid. So the data is very similar, but it's not exact.
Well, we understand there will be overlaps, but it would,
right,
to the extent you show us,
I just want to make sure it's clear.
Constituency groups, that's helpful.
We can do that.
Okay. And then I think the next is probably the 900 series.
900 series on page 26. And I actually did this by amount. What I did was I provided you with all contracts that are $25,000 or more and by vendor, the largest contract to the smallest. And what you'll see on page 28 is that we have 500 vendor contracts that are under $25,000. So I can provide you with the detail of that if you wish. But I thought, you know, you're probably going to focus on the, you know, top 25 or 30 anyway.
Madam Chairman, maybe if you just go through just a quick description of what each of these are so that we could just understand what these vendors do.
Sure. Madam Chair, the first vendor is ACS State Healthcare. That's our Medicaid claims provider. That's the largest contract that we have. The next vendor is Innovative Resource Group. You may hear about them referred to as APS. They actually do our we have a contract with them to monitor. They do reviews of hospital bills. They provide an 800 service for, if I'm wrong, they provide an 800 service for Medicaid claimants to call in to get advice so they don't just run to the emergency room if their child has a fever of 99, those types of things. And they do several other things as well.
General, where are those, for those top two vendors, where do they provide those services from?
ACS has an office in Cheyenne, and we work with that office, manages all of our claims. And APS also has an office in Cheyenne. I think their 800 facility is in Montana. They have their 800 number, call-in number. That call center is actually in Montana, and they serve several states, not just Wyoming. The University of Wyoming is in Laramie. Mr. Chairman, that's a myriad of services. They do a lot of. We have some contracts with them for surveys and evaluations, primarily on the DD. Mental health prevention and drug courts. Gould Health Systems is another Medicaid provider. They do our pharmacy benefit. They process the claims for all the pharmacy. Navigant Consulting is another Medicaid consultant. They help us with the various reviews that we have to do and determining that our rates are permissible. For example, they do our upper payment limit calculations. That's for the benefit of the committee. When we set a Medicaid rate, our average amount that we pay cannot be higher than the Medicare rate, and that is what is, in layman's terms, called the upper payment limit. And so we have to, they do verifications that we do meet that requirement for Medicaid. The Wyoming Hospital Association. I'm not sure what all is included there, but we can find that out if you want me to. The next one is Healthways QuitNet. I believe they run our tobacco cessation program.
Madam Chairman, maybe given, I think I'm interested in a lot of these things. I wonder if we could just get you in an appropriate time frame. It doesn't have to be immediately, to just put a purpose
description of services.
Description and give us that to us, and then instead of spending committee time going through
Mr.
it.
Mr. Chairman.
I think it's of great enough interest. I'd like to see it.
Representative Harshman.
Madam Chairman, and if you could, you know, Bob, I see when you get down farther, there's some that are just individuals that are listed. You know, there's one on page 26 for $228,000. Flip over to page 27, there's several in the 125s, just individuals. So when you tell us what those folks are doing, maybe tell us where they're from, you know, if they're outside of Wyoming or.
Sure.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Peterson.
Just a suggestion, you know, if you turn to page 19, we have the technology to print in two colors and maybe just list those out-of-staters in red.
Yeah.
I'm serious.
Yeah,
I mean, it would be so much easier to list those out-of-staters, and I think it would be a healthy exercise for this committee as well as each division and agency, every biennium, to see the bleed out. And that's why the red is appropriate.
Madam Chair.
One thing I did want to ask is, this package you gave to us, has this been provided to the Labor Committee? Have you gone over, have they seen a similar type product?
Mr. Chairman, it has not yet been provided to the Labor Committee.
To the extent that we've asked you in areas to clarify or whatever, but I think this is the worthwhile presentation to send to the Labor Committee.
Some have been. Some
each of the members.
Mr. Forsland.
Yeah. Madam Chairman, Senator Nicholas, in terms of the presentation of the overview of the department, the changes, and such, yes, that has been given to the Labor Committee.
Well, what we might do is before, when we're all finished, and we kind of what you're providing to us, I'd just like to have those folks get a maybe a packet before the session begins. That's so they can see what we've been receiving.
Mr. Forslin, do you have anything else you'd like to add to this packet that you've just handed out to us?
No.
Okay, great. In committee, what I think I'd like to do then is just break for lunch. We need a break, and I think it's better to just do it this way. And let's return at 12:45, please.
What is that? Thank you.
Yes. Shelley needs a copy of all the handouts.
Okay.
Presentation, whatever went to JAC. She was a good.
When you get a minute.